Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
It certainly became clear. It soon became clear, certainly too, that I was dealing with an extraordinarily complicated man, one haunted by a powerful sense of family pride, except that the sense of pride was tainted when he was growing up as a boy and later as an adolescent by an overwhelming element of frustration, denial, loss, and rage. Ellison once wrote about how close he came to killing people. He said he had to stop at one point and realize that he was now strong enough and angry enough that he might kill somebody. But the volcanic energy, anger, was in him, I think, to the very end. So there was no real serenity. James Baldwin, I think, called him the angriest man in America, even though he seemed to be anything but that. Albert Murray, his very, very close friend, also, you didn't want to meddle with Ralph Ellison. And there are rumors of his having pulled knives on various people, notably Chester Himes, although he himself denies that it ever took place. A Norman Mailer in Advertisements for Myself recalled, called him, quote, essentially a hateful writer. And I was so overwhelmed, stunned by that remark, that little section of Advertisements for Myself, because I said to myself, how could Mailer, without his such little knowledge of Ellison, I mean, they had met, each one disliked the other, but how could he penetrate like that to certain truths about Ellison? Well, I think that is the nature of genius. And we have, I don't use that term loosely, I'm using it now in a broader sense about both Mailer and about Ellison. But this quality, this idea of him being a hateful quality in his writing, we need not take that as gospel truth. But what Mailer was saying is that you can see in the writing the volcanic rage underneath it. Let's move on. Family pride had to do with the achievements, I would say, especially during Reconstruction and the post-Reconstruction of his father's family, especially his father's father, who during Reconstruction held a position that gave him authority over whites. He was respected, but when whites took over control of South Carolina, he was thrown out of office. But there was a legacy of a position of authority. There was a large, if decaying, house. And there was a certain amount of education, I think, passed on to Ralph's father. And all that was in the past. And that was the foundation of Ralph's family pride and the pride his mother warned him about. His mother warned him. She said, you know, you could go far in life, perhaps, but you have to watch out for that Ellison pride. And I think that pride persisted to the end of his life. And it helped him, and it also hurt him. I think it was part of the reason why he was not able to finish that second novel, because his standards had become so Olympian. One reason was his standards had become so Olympian that he was not prepared to do what some of his heroes were prepared to do, which is to write great novels, but also to write inferior stuff, and to realize that the career can tail off. No, he always wanted to write, you know, another superior a novel superior to Invisible Man. Indeed, in an interview for the Paris Review in 1954, he kind of dismisses Invisible Man. He says it failed, I failed of eloquence. The language wasn't good enough. Well, it's a fantastic novel, and for you to speak about it pejoratively in that way is to, you're asking for trouble if you think that you're going to easily surpass such a what is I think a masterpiece.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, June 8th, 2018. So I have been told. This is our sixth study session on Ralph Ellison's masterpiece, Invisible Man. We are picking up on chapter 11. The voice you just heard, Arnold Rampersad, black male. He wrote a biography. There's more than one biography on Ralph Ellison. He got access to his personal papers, very detailed. It's over 600 pages. He did a C-SPAN talk in 2007. Has lots of information both about the book and about Ellison's construction of the book and his life. Really important, I thought, particularly his comments about the anger, the rage that Ellison had. I think it comes through clearly in Invisible Man, all the way through the book, from the very beginning all the way to the end. I kind of keep that in mind with the criticisms of people who said, oh, Ellison's an Uncle Tom. Who's going to write a book about a black guy, you know, going to sit and think in the middle of racism? Why isn't he going out and killing people? I guess that could be one interpretation. I think if you read this book and miss the anger about the abuse of white supremacy racism, you are probably not getting a deep enough appreciation and understanding for what Ellison is doing. Folks can certainly share their thoughts, as well as the Ellison Pride, if folks have any thoughts on that. Dr. Kevorkian did respond. I asked him about Lucius Brockway's name, the significance, and about the black substance that's added to the optic white paint being called dope. He answered both queries, and I will share them as we roll. For now, we will get started. We are on chapter 11, Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, narrated by the great Joe Morton. Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one.
I was sitting in a cold, white, rigid chair, and a man was looking at me out of a bright third eye that glowed from the center of his forehead. He reached out, touching my skull gingerly, and said something encouraging, as though I were a child. His fingers went away. "Take this," he said. "It's good for you." I swallowed. Suddenly, my skin itched all over. I had on new overalls, strange white ones. The taste ran bitter through my mouth. My fingers trembled. A thin voice with a mirror on the end of it said, "How is he?" "I don't think it's anything serious, merely stunned."
"Should he be sent home now?"
"No, just to be certain, we'll keep him here for a few days. Want to keep him under observation. Then he may leave." Now I was lying on a cot, the bright eye still burning into mine, although the man was gone. It was quiet, and I was numb. I closed my eyes only to be awakened.
"What is your name?" a voice said.
"My head," I said.
"Yes, but your name, address?"
"My head, that burning eye," I said.
"Eye?"
"Inside," I said.
"Shoot him up for an X-ray,"
another voice said.
My head...
"Careful."
Somewhere, a machine began to hum, and I distrusted the man and woman above me. They were holding me firm, and it was fiery, and above it all, I kept hearing the opening motif of Beethoven's Fifth. Three short and one long buzz, repeated again and again in varying volume, and I was struggling and breaking through, rising up to find myself lying on my back with two pink-faced men laughing down. "Be quiet now," one of them said firmly. "You'll be all right." I raised my eyes, seeing two indefinite young women in white looking down at me. A third, a desert of heat waves away, sat at a panel arrayed with coils and dials. Where was I? From far below me, a barber chair thumping began, and I felt myself rise on the tip of the sound from the floor. A face was now level with mine, looking closely and saying something without meaning. A whirring began that snapped and cracked with static, and suddenly I seemed to be crushed between the floor and ceiling. Two forces tore savagely at my stomach and back. A flash of cold-edged heat enclosed me. I was pounded between crushing electrical pressures, pumped between live electrodes like an accordion between a player's hands. My lungs were compressed like a bellows, and each time my breath returned, I yelled, punctuating the rhythmical action of the nodes.
"Hush, goddammit," one of the voices ordered. "We're trying to get you started again. Now shut up."
The voice throbbed with icy authority, and I quieted and tried to contain the pain. I discovered now that my head was encircled by a piece of cold metal like the iron cap worn by the occupant of an electric chair. I tried unsuccessfully to struggle, to cry out, but the people were so remote, the pain so immediate. A face moved in and out of the circle of lights, peering for a moment, then disappeared. A freckled, red-haired woman with gold nose glasses appeared. Then a man with a circular mirror attached to his forehead. A doctor. Yes, he was a doctor, and the women were nurses. It was coming clear. I was in a hospital. They would care for me. It was all geared toward the easing of pain. Ah, I felt thankful. I tried to remember how I'd gotten here, but nothing came. My mind was blank, as though I had just begun to live. When the next face appeared, I saw the eyes behind the thick glasses blinking, as though noticing me for the first time. "You're all right, boy. You're okay. You just be patient," said the voice, hollow with profound attachment. I seemed to go away. The lights receded like a taillight racing down a dark country road. I couldn't follow. A sharp pain stabbed my shoulder. I twisted about on my back, fighting something I couldn't see. Then after a while, my vision cleared. Now a man sitting with his back to me, manipulating dials on a panel. I wanted to call him, but the Fifth Symphony rhythm racked me, and he seemed too serene and too far away. Bright metal bars were between us, and when I strained my neck around, I discovered that I was not lying on an operating table, but in a kind of glass and nickel box, the lid of which was propped open. Why was I here? "Doctor! Doctor!" I called. No answer. Perhaps he hadn't heard, I thought. Calling again and feeling the stabbing pulses of the machine again and feeling myself going under and fighting against it and coming up to hear voices carrying on a conversation behind my head. The static sounds became a quiet drone. Strains of music, a Sunday air drifted from a distance. With closed eyes, barely breathing, I warded off the pain. The voices droned harmoniously. Was it a radio I heard? A phonograph? The vox humana of a hidden organ? If so, what organ and where? I felt warm. Green hedges, dazzling with red wild roses, appeared behind my eyes, stretching with a gentle curving to an infinity empty of objects, a limpid blue space. Scenes of a shaded lawn in summer drifted past. I saw a uniformed military band arrayed decorously in concert. Each musician with well-oiled hair heard a sweet-voiced trumpet rendering the holy city as from an echoing distance, buoyed by a choir of muted horns. And above, the mocking obbligato of a mockingbird. I felt giddy. The air seemed to grow thick with fine, white gnats, filling my eyes, boiling so thickly that the dark trumpeter breathed them in and expelled them through the bell of his golden horn, a live white cloud mixing with the tones upon the torpid air. I came back. The voices still droned above me, and I disliked them. Why didn't they go away? Smug ones. Oh, doctor, I thought drowsily, did you ever wade in a brook before breakfast? Ever chew on sugar cane? You know, Doc, the same fall day I first saw the hounds chasing black men in stripes and chains, my grandmother sat with me and sang with twinkling eyes. God Almighty made a monkey. God Almighty made a whale. And God Almighty made a gator with hickeys all over his tail. Or you, nurse? Did you know that when you strolled in pink organdy and picture hat between the rows of Cape jasmine cooing to your bow in a drawl as thick as sorghum, we little black boys hidden snug in the bushes called out so loud that you daren't hear? Did you ever see Miss Margaret boil water? Man, she hisses a wonderful stream. 17 miles and a quarter. Man, and you can't see her pot for the steam. But now the music became a distinct wail of female pain. I opened my eyes. Glass and metal floated above me. How are you feeling, boy? A voice said. A pair of eyes peered down through lenses as thick as the bottom of a Coca-Cola bottle, eyes protruding, luminous and vain like an old biology specimen preserved in alcohol. I don't have enough room, I said angrily. Oh, that's a necessary part of the treatment. But I need more room, I insisted. I'm cramped. Don't worry about it, boy. You'll get used to it after a while. How is your stomach and head?
Stomach?
Yes, and your head.
I don't know, I said, realizing that I could feel nothing beyond the pressure around my head and on the tender surface of my body. Yet my senses seemed to focus sharply. I don't feel it, I cried, alarmed.
Aha! You see? My little gadget will solve everything, he exploded.
I don't know, another voice said. I think I still prefer surgery, and in this case especially with this, background, I'm not so sure that I don't believe in the effectiveness of simple prayer.
Nonsense. From now on, do your praying to my little machine. I'll deliver the cure.
I don't know, but I believe it a mistake to assume that solutions, cures, that is, that apply in primitive instances are equally effective when more advanced conditions are in question. Suppose it were a New Englander with a Harvard background.
Now you're arguing politics, the first voice said banteringly.
Oh, no, but it is a problem.
I listened with growing uneasiness to the conversation fuzzing away to a whisper. The simplest words seemed to refer to something else, as did many of the notions that unfurled through my head. I wasn't sure whether they were talking about me or someone else. Some of it sounded like a discussion of history. The machine will produce the result of a prefrontal lobotomy without the negative effects of the knife, the voice said. You see, instead of severing the prefrontal lobe, a single lobe, that is, we apply pressure in the proper degrees to the major centers of nerve control. Our concept is gestalt, and the result is as complete a change of personality as you'll find in your famous fairy tale cases of criminals transformed into amiable fellows after all that bloody business of a brain operation. And what's more, the voice went on triumphantly, the patient is both physically and neurally whole.
But what of his psychology?
Absolutely of no importance, the voice said. The patient will live as he has to live, and with absolute integrity. Who could ask more? He'll experience no major conflict of motives, and what is even better, society will suffer no traumata on his account. There was a pause. A pen scratched upon paper. Then,
"Why not castration, doctor?"
a voice asked waggishly, causing me to start, a pain tearing through me. "There goes your love of blood again," the first voice laughed. "What's that definition of a surgeon? A butcher with a bad conscience?" They laughed.
"It's not so funny. It would be more scientific to try to define the case. It has been developing some 300 years.
"Define? Hell, man, we know all that.
Then why don't you try more current?"
"You suggested."
"I do. Why not?"
"But isn't there a danger?" The voice trailed off. I heard them move away. A chair scraped. The machine droned, and I knew definitely that they were discussing me and steeled myself for the shocks, but was blasted nevertheless. The pulse came swift and staccato, increasing gradually until I fairly danced between the nodes. My teeth chattered. I closed my eyes and bit my lips to smother my screams. Warm blood filled my mouth between my lids. I saw a circle of hands and faces dazzling with light. Some were scribbling upon charts.
"Look, he's dancing," someone called.
"No, really?" An oily face looked in.
"They really do have rhythm, don't they? Get hot, boy, get hot," it said with a laugh.
And suddenly my bewilderment suspended, and I wanted to be angry, murderously angry. But somehow the pulse of current smashing through my body prevented me. Something had been disconnected. For though I had seldom used my capacities for anger and indignation, I had no doubt that I possessed them, and like a man who knows that he must fight whether angry or not, when called a son of a bitch, I tried to imagine myself angry, only to discover a deeper sense of remoteness. I was beyond anger. I was only bewildered, and those above seemed to sense it. There was no avoiding the shock, and I rolled with the agitated tide out into the blackness. When I emerged, the lights were still there. I lay beneath the slab of glass, feeling deflated. All my limbs seemed amputated. It was very warm. A dim white ceiling stretched far above me. My eyes were swimming with tears. Why, I didn't know. It worried me. I wanted to knock on the glass to attract attention, but I couldn't move. The slightest effort, hardly more than desire, tired me. I lay experiencing the vague processes of my body. I seemed to have lost all sense of proportion. Where did my body end and the crystal and white world begin? Thoughts evaded me, hiding in the vast stretch of clinical whiteness to which I seemed connected only by a scale of receding grays. No sounds beyond the sluggish inner roar of the blood. I couldn't open my eyes. I seemed to exist in some other dimension, utterly alone, until, after a while, a nurse bent down and forced a warm fluid between my lips. I gagged, swallowed, feeling the fluid course slowly to my vague middle. A huge, iridescent bubble seemed to enfold me. Gentle hands moved over me, bringing vague impressions of memory. I was laved with warm liquids, felt gentle hands move through the indefinite limits of my flesh. The sterile and weightless texture of a sheet enfolded me. I felt myself bounce, sail off like a ball, thrown over the roof into mist, striking a hidden wall beyond a pile of broken machinery and sailing back. How long it took, I didn't know. But now, above the movement of the hands, I heard a friendly voice uttering familiar words to which I could assign no meaning. I listened intensely, aware of the form and movement of sentences and grasping the now subtle rhythmical differences between progressions of sound that questioned and those that made a statement but still their meanings were lost in the vast whiteness in which I myself was lost. Other voices emerged. Faces hovered above me like inscrutable fish peering myopically through a glass aquarium wall. I saw them suspended, motionless, above me, then two floating off, first their heads, then the tips of their fin-like fingers, moving dreamily from the top of the case. A thoroughly mysterious coming and going, like the surging of torpid tides. I watched the two make furious movements with their mouths. I didn't understand. They tried again, the meaning still escaping me. I felt uneasy. I saw a scribbled card held over me, all a jumble of alphabets. They consulted heatedly. Somehow I felt responsible. A terrible sense of loneliness came over me. They seemed to enact a mysterious pantomime, and seeing them from this angle was disturbing. They appeared utterly stupid, and I didn't like it. It wasn't right. I could see smut in one doctor's nose. A nurse had two flabby chins. Other faces came up, their mouths working with soundless fury. But we are all human, I thought, wondering what I meant. A man dressed in black appeared, a long-haired fellow whose piercing eyes looked down upon me out of an intense and friendly face. The others hovered about him, their eyes anxious, as he alternately peered at me and consulted my chart. Then he scribbled something on a large card and thrust it before my eyes. "What is your name?" A tremor shook me. It was as though he had suddenly given a name to, had organized the vagueness that drifted through my head, and I was overcome with swift shame. I realized I no longer knew my own name. I shut my eyes and shook my head with sorrow. Here was the first warm attempt to communicate with me, and I was failing. I tried again, plunging into the blackness of my mind. It was no use. I found nothing but pain. I saw the card again, and he pointed slowly to each word. "What is your name?" I tried desperately, diving below the blackness until I was limp with fatigue. It was as though a vein had been opened and my energy siphoned away. I could only stare back mutely. But with an irritating burst of activity, he gestured for another card and wrote, "Who are you?" Something inside me turned with a sluggish excitement. This phrasing of the question seemed to set off a series of weak and distant lights where the other had thrown a spark that failed. Who am I? I asked myself. But it was like trying to identify one particular cell that coursed through the torpid veins of my body. Maybe I was just this blackness and bewilderment and pain, but that seemed less like a suitable answer than something I'd read somewhere. The card was back again. "What is your mother's name?" Mother. Who was my mother? Mother. The one who screams when you suffer, but who? This is stupid. You always knew your mother's name. Who was it that screamed? Mother! But the scream came from the machine. A machine? My mother? Oh, clearly I was out of my head. He shot questions at me. Where were you born? Try to think of your name. I tried, thinking vainly of many names, but none seemed to fit, and yet it was as though I was somehow a part of all of them, had become submerged within them and lost. You must remember, the placard read. But it was useless. Each time I found myself back in the clinging white mist in my name just beyond my fingertips.
I shook my head and watched him disappear for a moment and return with a companion, a short, scholarly-looking man who stared at me with a blank expression. I watched him produce a child's slate and a piece of chalk, writing upon it, "Who was your mother?" I looked at him, feeling a quick dislike and thinking, half in amusement, "I don't play the dozens, and how's your old lady today?" "Think," I stared, seeing him frown and write a long time. The slate was filled with meaningless names. I smiled, seeing his eyes blaze with annoyance. Old friendly face said something. The new man wrote a question at which I stared in wide-eyed amazement. "Who was Buckeye the Rabbit?" I was filled with turmoil. Why should he think of that? He pointed to the question, word by word. I laughed deep, deep inside me, giddy with the delight of self-discovery and the desire to hide it somehow. I was Buckeye the Rabbit, or had been, when as children we danced and sang barefoot in the dusty streets. Buckeye the Rabbit, shake it, Buckeye the Rabbit, break it. Yes, I could not bring myself to admit it. It was too ridiculous and somehow too dangerous. It was annoying that he had hit upon an old identity, and I shook my head, seeing him purse his lips and eye me sharply. "Boy, who was Brer Rabbit?" "He's your mother's back door man," I thought. "Anyone knew they were one and the same, Buckeye, when you were very young and hid yourself behind wide innocent eyes, Brer, when you were older. But why was he playing around with these childish names? Did he think I was a child? Why didn't they leave me alone? I would remember soon enough when they let me out of the machine." A palm smacked sharply upon the glass, but I was tired of them. Yet as my eyes focused upon old friendly face, he seemed pleased. I couldn't understand it, but there he was, smiling and leaving with the new assistant. Left alone, I lay fretting over my identity. I suspected that I was really playing a game with myself and that they were taking part, a kind of combat. Actually, they knew as well as I, and I, for some reason, preferred not to face it. It was irritating, and it made me feel sly and alert. I would solve the mystery the next instant. I imagined myself whirling about in my mind like an old man attempting to catch a small boy in some mischief, thinking, "Who am I? It was no good." I felt like a clown, nor was I up to being both criminal and detective, though why criminal, I didn't know. I fell to plotting ways of short-circuiting the machine. Perhaps if I shifted my body about so that the two nodes would come together. No. Not only was there no room, but it might electrocute me. I shuddered. Whoever else I was no Samson. I had no desire to destroy myself, even if I destroyed the machine. I wanted freedom, not destruction. It was exhausting, for no matter what the scheme I conceived, there was one constant flaw. Myself! There was no getting around it. I could no more escape than I could think of my identity. Perhaps, I thought, the two things are involved with each other. When I discover who I am, I'll be free. It was as though my thoughts of escape had alerted them. I looked up to see two agitated physicians, a nurse, and thought, it's too late now, and lay in a veil of sweat watching them manipulate the controls. I was braced for the usual shock, but nothing happened. Instead, I saw their hands at the lid, loosening the bolt, and before I could react, they opened the lid and pulled me erect. "What's happened?" I began, seeing the nurse pause to look at me.
"Well,"
she said. My mouth worked soundlessly.
"Come on, get it out," she said.
"What hospital is this?" I said. It's the factory hospital, she said. Now, be quiet. They were around me now, inspecting my body, and I watched with growing bewilderment, thinking, what is a factory hospital? I felt a tug in my belly and looked down to see one of the physicians pull the cord which was attached to the stomach node, jerking me forward. What is this? I said.
Get the shears, he said.
Sure, the other said. Let's not waste time. I recoiled inwardly as though the cord were part of me. Then they had it free, and the nurse clipped through the belly band and removed the heavy node. I opened my mouth to speak, but one of the physicians shook his head. They worked swiftly. The node's off, the nurse went over me with rubbing alcohol. Then I was told to climb out of the case. I looked from face to face, overcome with indecision. For now that it appeared that I was being freed, I dared not believe it. What if they were transferring me to some even more painful machine? I sat there, refusing to move. Should I struggle against them?
Take his arm, one of them said.
I can do it, I said, climbing fearfully out. I was told to stand while they went over my body with the stethoscope. How's the articulation? The one with the chart said as the other examined my shoulder.
Perfect, he said.
I could feel a tightness there, but no pain.
I'd say he's surprisingly strong, considering, the other said.
Shall we call in Drexel? It seems rather unusual for him to be so strong.
Now, just note it on the chart.
All right. Nurse, give him his clothes.
What are you going to do with me? I said.
She handed me clean underclothing and a pair of white overalls. No questions, she said. Just dress as quickly as possible. The air outside the machine seemed extremely rare. When I bent over to tie my shoes, I thought I would faint, but fought it off. I stood shakily, and they looked me up and down. Well, boy, it looks as though you're cured, one of them said. You're a new man. You came through fine. Come with us, he said. We went slowly out of the room and down a long white corridor into an elevator, then swiftly down three floors to a reception room with rows of chairs. At the front were a number of private offices with frosted glass doors and walls. Sit down there, they said. The director will see you shortly. I sat, seeing them disappear inside one of the offices for a second and emerge, passing me without a word. I trembled like a leaf. Were they really freeing me? My head spun. I looked at my white overalls. The nurse said that this was the factory hospital. I could not remember what kind of factory it was, and why a factory hospital. Yes, I did remember some vague factory. Perhaps I was being sent back there. Yes, and he'd spoken of the director instead of the head doctor. Could they be one and the same? Perhaps I was in the factory already. I listened, but could hear no machinery. Across the room, a newspaper lay on a chair, but I was too concerned to get it. Somewhere a fan droned. Then one of the doors with frosted glass was opened, and I saw a tall, austere-looking man in a white coat beckoning to me with a chart.
Come,
he said. I got up and went past him into a large, simply furnished office, thinking, now, I'll know, now.
Sit down, he said.
I eased myself into the chair beside his desk. He watched me with a calm, scientific gaze.
What is your name?
Oh, here, I have it, he said, studying the chart. And it was as though someone inside of me tried to tell him to be silent, but already he had called my name, and I heard myself say, oh! As a pain stabbed through my head, and I shot to my feet and looked wildly around me and sat down and got up and down again very fast, remembering. I don't know why I did it, but suddenly I saw him looking at me intently, and I stayed down this time.
He began asking questions, and I could hear myself replying fluently, though inside I was reeling with swiftly changing emotional images that shrilled and chattered like a soundtrack reversed at high speed. "Well, my boy," he said, "you're cured. We are going to release you. How does that strike you?" Suddenly, I didn't know. I noticed a company calendar beside a stethoscope and a miniature silver paintbrush. Did he mean from the hospital or from the job? "Sir," I said.
"I said, how does that strike you?"
"All right, sir," I said in an unreal voice. "I'll be glad to get back to work." He looked at the chart, frowning.
"You'll be released, but I'm afraid that you'll be disappointed about the work," he said.
"What do you mean, sir?"
"You've been through a severe experience," he said. "You aren't ready for the rigors of industry. Now, I want you to rest, undertake a period of convalescence. You need to become readjusted and get your strength back."
But, sir, you mustn't try to go too fast.
You're glad to be released, are you not?"
"Oh, yes. But how shall I live?"
"Live?" His eyebrows raised and lowered. "Take another job," he said. "Something easier, quieter, something for which you're better prepared."
Prepared. I looked at him, thinking, is he in on it too?
I'll take anything, sir, I said. "That isn't the problem, my boy. You just aren't prepared for work under our industrial conditions. Later, perhaps, but not now. And remember, you'll be adequately compensated for your experience."
"Compensated, sir?"
"Oh, yes," he said. "We follow a policy of enlightened humanitarianism. All our employees are automatically insured. You have only to sign a few papers."
What kind of papers, sir?"
"We require an affidavit releasing the company of responsibility," he said. "Yours was a difficult case, and a number of specialists had to be called in. But after all, any new occupation has its hazards. They are part of growing up, of becoming adjusted, as it were. One takes a chance, and while some are prepared, others are not."
I looked at his lined face. Was he doctor, factory official, or both? I couldn't get it. Now he seemed to move back and forth across my field of vision, although he sat perfectly calm in his chair. It came out of itself. "Do you know Mr. Norton, sir?" I said.
"Norton?" His brows knitted. "What Norton is this?"
Then it was as though I hadn't asked him. The name sounded strange. I ran my hand over my eyes. I'm sorry, I said. "It occurred to me that you might. He was just a man I used to know."
"I see. Well," he picked up some papers. "So, that's the way it is, my boy. A little later, perhaps, we'll be able to do something. You may take the papers along if you wish. Just mail them to us. Your check will be sent upon their return. Meanwhile, take as much time as you like. You'll find that we are perfectly fair."
I took the folded papers and looked at him for what seemed to be too long a time. He seemed to waver. Then I heard myself say, "Do you know him?" My voice rising.
"Who?"
"Mr. Norton," I said. "Mr. Norton."
"Oh, why no?"
"No," I said. "No one knows anybody. And it was too long a time ago." He frowned and I laughed. "They picked poor Robin clean," I said. "Do you happen to know Bled?" He looked at me, his head to one side.
"Are these people friends of yours?"
"Friends?" "Oh, yes," I said. "We're all good friends, buddies from way back, but I don't suppose we get around in the same circles." His eyes widened.
"No," he said, "I don't suppose we do. However, good friends are valuable to have."
I felt lightheaded and started to laugh, and he seemed to waver again, and I thought of asking him about Emerson, but now he was clearing his throat and indicating that he was finished. I put the folded papers in my overalls and started out. The door beyond the rows of chairs seemed far away.
"Take care of yourself," he said.
"And you," I said, thinking. "It's time. It's past time." Turning abruptly, I went weakly back to the desk, seeing him looking up at me with his steady, scientific gaze. I was overcome with ceremonial feelings, but unable to remember the proper formula. So as I deliberately extended my hand, I fought down laughter with a cough. "It's been quite pleasant, our little palaver, sir," I said. I listened to myself and to his answer.
"Yes, indeed," he said.
He shook my hand gravely, without surprise or distaste. I looked down. He was there somewhere behind the lined face and outstretched hand. "And now our palaver is finished," I said. "Goodbye." He raised his hand.
"Goodbye," he said, his voice noncommittal.
Leaving him and going out into the paint-fuming air, I had the feeling that I had been talking beyond myself, had used words and expressed attitudes not my own, that I was in the grip of some alien personality lodged deep within me, like the servant about whom I'd read in psychology class who, during a trance, had recited pages of Greek philosophy, which she had overheard one day while she worked. It was as though I were acting out a scene from some crazy movie. Or perhaps I was catching up with myself and had put into words feelings which I had hitherto suppressed. Or was it, I thought, starting up the walk, that I was no longer afraid? I stopped, looking at the buildings down the bright street slanting with sun and shade. I was no longer afraid. Not of important men, not of trustees and such. For knowing now that there was nothing which I could expect from them, there was no reason to be afraid. Was that it? I felt lightheaded. My ears were ringing. I went on. Along the walk, the buildings rose, uniform and close together. It was day's end now, and on top of every building, the flags were fluttering and diving down, collapsing. And I felt that I would fall, had fallen, move now as against a current sweeping swiftly against me. Out of the grounds and up the street I found the bridge by which I'd come, but the stairs leading back to the car that crossed the top were too dizzily steep to climb, swim, or fly. And I found a subway instead. Things whirled too fast around me. My mind went alternately bright and blank in slow rolling waves. We, he, him, my mind and I were no longer getting around in the same circles, nor my body either. Across the aisle, a young platinum blonde nibbled at a red delicious apple as station lights rippled past behind her. The train plunged. I dropped through the roar, giddy and vacuum-minded, sucked under and out into late afternoon Harlem. When I came out of the subway, Lenox Avenue seemed to careen away from me at a drunken angle, and I focused upon the teetering scene with wild infant's eyes, my head throbbing. Two huge women with spoiled cream complexions seemed to struggle with their massive bodies as they came past, their flowered hips trembling like threatening flames. Out across the walk before me, they moved, and a bright orange slant of sun seemed to boil up, and I saw myself going down, my legs watery beneath me, but my head clear, too clear, recording the crowd swerving around me, legs, feet, eyes, hands, bent knees, scuffed shoes, teethy-eyed excitement, and some moving on, unhalting, and the big, dark woman saying, "Boy, is you all right? What's wrong?" in a husky voice contralto, and me saying, I'm all right, just weak, and trying to stand, and her saying, "Why don't y'all stand back and let the man breathe? Stand back there, y'all," and now echoed by an official tone, "Keep moving, break it up," and she on one side and a man on the other, helping me to stand, and the policeman saying, "Are you all right?" and me answering, "Yes, I just felt weak. I must have fainted, but all right now." And him ordering the crowd to move on, and the others moving on except the man and woman, and him saying, "You sure you okay, Daddy?" And me nodding, "Yes," and her saying, "Where you live, son? Somewhere around here?" And me telling her, "Men's house," and her looking at me, shaking her head, saying, "Men's house? Men's house? Shucks, that ain't no place for nobody in your condition what's weak and needs a woman to keep an eye on you a while." And me saying, "But I'll be all right now." And her, "Maybe you will be and maybe you won't. I just live up the street and round the corner. You better come on round and rest till you feel stronger. I'll phone Men's house and tell him where you at." And me too tired to resist, and already she had one arm and was instructing the fellow to take the other, and we went, me between them, inwardly rejecting and yet accepting her bossing, hearing, "You take it easy. I'll take care of you like I done a heap of others. My name's Mary Rambo. Everybody knows me around this part of Harlem. You heard of me, ain't you?" And the fellow saying, "Sure, I'm Jenny Jackson's boy. You know I know you, Miss Mary." And her saying, "Jenny Jackson? Why, I should say you do know me. And I know you. You Ralston. And your mama got two more children, boy named Flint, gal named Laura Jean. I should say I know you. Me and your mama and your papa used to..." And me saying, I'm all right now, really, really, all right." And her saying, "And looking like that, you must be worse off even than you look." And pulling me now, saying, "Here's my house right here. Help me get him up the steps and inside. You needn't worry, son. I ain't never laid eyes on you before, and it ain't my business. And I don't care what you think about me, but you weak and can't hardly walk at all, and you look what's more like you hungry. So just come on and let me do something for you, like I'd hope you'd do something for old Mary in case she needed it. It ain't costing you a penny. And I don't want to get in your business. I just want you to lay down till you rested, and then you can go." And the fellow taking it up, saying, "You in good hands, Daddy. Miss Mary always helping somebody. And you need some help, because here you black as me and white as a sheet, as the old phase would say. Watch these steps." And going up some steps, and then some more, growing weaker, and the two warm around me, on each side of me, and then inside a cool, dark room, hearing, Here's the bed. Lie him down there. There now, that's it. Ralston, now put his legs up. Never mind the cover. There, that's it. Now, go out there in the kitchen and pour him a glass of water. You'll find a bottle in the ice box." And him going, and her placing another pillow beneath my head, saying, "Now you'll be better. And when you get all right, you'll know how bad a shape you've been in. Here, now, take a sip of this water." And me drinking and seeing her warm brown fingers holding the bright glass, and a feeling of old, almost forgotten relief coming over me, and thinking in echo of her words, "If I don't think I'm sinking, look what a hole I'm in." And then the soft, cool splash of sleep.
Context of white supremacy. So that would be the end of our first audio segment. We are kind of midpoint, kind of early-ish in chapter 12. We did not stop directly at the end of a chapter this time, but that's the way it is some days. If you would like to participate, to share thoughts, views, question, feel free. The number 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you would like to join the dialogue, but you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. It is linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.ty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. Address again, tiny.ty.cc/1race. And that is the number 1. When you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You will see a link for the free VOPE line. Once you click that link, it will open a small window on your screen. The first line is a drop-down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The code 564-943. Next line, the final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name, nickname, press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure. If you would like to participate, you'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61. I will see your hand on the switchboard. We will add you to the line. I said at the beginning of the broadcast that last week, I think I asked about the significance of Lucius Brockway, his name. Ellison, brilliant, genius author, picked these names deliberately, and perhaps there should be some thought as to why he chose the names for the characters in the text, especially important characters like Lucius Brockway. That was a question that I asked, and then I think it may have been read in Nevada. She can, you know, set me straight if I have not remembered correctly, but I think she asked about why the black substance that's added to the optic white paint, why that is called dope. That was from last week, and I was stumped on that one. I don't recall if we had responses immediately to that query, but I asked Dr. Kevorkian about both, and these are his responses. He said, "The questions definitely got me thinking. Always a rewarding activity in response to Ellison's great novel. The book is very carefully written, and such details are worth considering. That said, I will attempt to answer the second question first. I am slightly more confident about my theory for that one, and I'm not sure about either. But my theories for question one, Lucius Brockway, mostly derive from my overall theory for question two, dope." So the word dope. The word dope can have many different meanings, and these meanings were all current at Ellison's time. But one thing that they tend to have in common is that dope is some kind of unspecified additive, one that is necessary for a particular purpose, but that is often not explicitly authorized or even legal. In contemporary sports, people speak of doping scandals in this way, though it looks like performance-enhancing idea first applied to animals and machines. Here are some of those related meanings from the Oxford English Dictionary. A preparation, mixture, or drug which is not specifically named. Stuff, that is a synonym, slang, first used in 1872. Next, a substance added to petrol or other fuel, etc., to increase its efficiency, an additive. Next, a medical preparation administered to a racehorse for the purpose of affecting its performance, 1901. I think these meanings all fit with the idea that the whiteness of the paint depends upon the secret ingredient of the black liquid, just as whiteness and white supremacy have an unacknowledged dependency on non-white people. Dope can, of course, also be a drug or narcotic, the slang term for opium, one that could blind people to truth. Opium, especially the thick treacle-like preparation used in opium smoking, hence applied to stupefying drugs and narcotics in general, or to alcoholic drink, slang, used this way since 1986. So all of that definition for dope, very interesting that in the definition or one of the older meanings for dope, to blind people. In this here book, Invisible Man, wowee. Figuratively, dope can be used to describe both a secret truth and the deceptions that hide the truth. Information, especially on a particular subject, or of a kind not widely disseminated or easily obtained. A statement of facts or essential details, also information, a statement, etc., designed to gloss over or disguise facts. Flattering or misleading talk, slang. I did not even know that that is another definition for the term dope. Wow. Lucius Brockway is the one who knows the straight dope about the white liberty paint, that white freedom had been built upon black enslavement. The white paint, like the white paint you mentioned in Black Mirror, is used to cover the truth of this necessary black presence. Black Mirror season 4, there's an episode where there is a black machine, a black dog that is hunting and killing everybody, kills a black person first. And at the end, the conquest of this black machine, it's doused in white paint, which I thought was symbolic. We talked about that when Dr. Kevorkian was with us a few months ago. Anyway, continuing. The white paint is used to cover the truth of this necessary black presence. In this sense, both the white paint and black additive are dope in these opposite related senses of the hidden truth and the thing that it hides. How about that? All right, so this is question one about the name of Lucius Brockway. In chapter 10, Lucius Brockway declares that our white is so white you can paint a chunk of coal and you'd have to crack it open with a sledgehammer to prove it isn't white clear through. One possible association of Brockway is the name itself hides a chunk of coal, just as Liberty Paint hides its secret ingredient of the black doping additive. That is Brockway, with spelled B-R-O-C-K. W-A-Y with rock, is a more or less white-sounding name. The Brockway family was, for instance, a pioneer family in Pennsylvania or founders of a carriage motor company in 1875 New York. Brockway, the name, contains within it a hidden rock, R-O-C-K. I admit that maybe that interpretation is a stretch, but it is consistent at least with the larger pattern of whiteness concealing its dependence on a hidden black ingredient. A perhaps even less likely significance is that Brock can refer to a badger and, according to the Oxford English Dictionary, to one who is given dirty tricks, a skunk, and referring to the streaked face of the badger. So I wonder if there's something going on there with the reference to deceptive black and white patterns again. Brockway is the one who knows that the way to make paint white is actually to mix in black. I would only add that Lucius is an ancient Roman Latin name, so it is consistent with being a slave name, in quotes, as slaves were often given names from Greek or Roman antiquity. More recently, we might think of Cassius Clay changing his name to Muhammad Ali, with Cassius being a similarly traditional Latin name. But Lucius in particular means light or to shine. Lucius Brockway is one who has knowledge to shine a light of truth on a hidden lie of white supremacy. Dr. Martin Kevorkian, his thoughts on two questions that came up from last week. If you have any thoughts on what Dr. Kevorkian had to say, if you think he might have been practicing racism in the responses, certainly if you have any thoughts on what we just read from chapters 11 and the little bit that we heard from 12, if you have commentary to share, line should be open. Feel free to chime in.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
I just took some notes. I think the author is doing a really good job in this book of exploring a lot of issues through this individual character, and his lack of individuality is the most intriguing part to me. And I think it's really what allows him to explore these social issues in more depth. Because even though he's exploring it through an individual frame, he doesn't have an identity. So that was a little weird thing I noticed in this book that I really liked. In this chapter, though, I think the bloodlust and the objectification of his body by the doctors, it reminded me of Harriet Washington's book about medical apartheid, how they put him in pretty much a petri dish. Like he was some type of organism they were just working on. He wasn't really human. I wrote a response to the word dope that Dr. Kevorkian, some of the things he wrote out. But it reminded me of a quote by Walter Rodney when he talked about how the white substance needed and depended on the ingestion of the black substance to be what it is. Walter Rodney wrote that the essence of white power is that it is exercised over black people. So that quote came to mind as soon as I heard that. The main character, his lack of memory, I think is really cool because it allows him to explore and really stand in for black people with having that lack of history. That and really shows how where we're located sociopolitically, white domination doesn't allow us to have a coherent history. Or doesn't want us to have a coherent history, assaults every attempt at building a coherent history and identity through complete genocide. And then the last thing I wanted to point out was Dr. Drexel. So he goes to meet Dr. Drexel, and they let him know that they're going to release him. A lot of language comes up that is, because the book takes place in the 1920s, at this time, science called ethnology is very popular in the American Academy. And physiology and anthropology. And so the doctor says, just things I heard, he said, we are perfectly fair, that you are not adequate enough. One day you will be developed enough. You're not ready. And he said, we are enlightened humanitarianism. Are we practice enlightened humanitarianism? And all of that language reminded me of an article that Marimba Ani wrote under her name Donna Richards. It's called The Ideology of White Domination, of European Domination, the Ideology. And she talks about how the language of 17th century Victorian social evolutionist thought, this idea that every race goes through two or three stages of development, from savagery to barbarism to full civilization, and how this language of him being not ready, not developed, not adequate, it's really hinting at the cultural superiority of whiteness. Like that Dr. Drexel, he's embodying the industriousness, the scientific progress of Europeans, what they promote as themselves, and he's projecting that type of value system onto the character, telling him that he's not quite up to par, not up to the white / right standards to participate in that company and to be hired there anymore. So I thought it was interesting how right after the character is really standing in and confronting the absence of identity that comes with blackness, the lack of control over your own interpretation. Immediately, he comes into this word soup of white domination and ideology of being labeled not developed. Because I think his mind is wiped away. And so the first thing he's introduced to are these self-deprecating ideals through the doctor that's releasing him into the hospital. So before he even steps into the world, he's been reoriented to think that he's not adequate enough. And this character has been going through that a lot. I mean, just through all of these chapters, he's experiencing these very tense moments. Like when he was with Mr. Norton, he was very tense. He goes to this new job. He's very nervous. It's just a lot of extremes back and forth. So that's all I wanted to point out. Thanks.
Appreciate that, Jay in St. Louis. Great observations. I think there's been lots of that sort of talk about Black people being primitive, inadequate throughout the text. We even heard some of that last week when the tirade was being given about the main character being a fink when he went to get his pork chop sandwich for lunch. And they were talking about he's not up to par and they're not quite intelligent enough to do this type of work. They're not quite as skilled as the white laborers who've been working there. Quite a bit of that sort of language throughout this text. Remind me of Lothrop Stoddard, The Rising Tide of Color Against White World Supremacy. We read on the book club right after our current president won the election in 2016. Other folks who dialed in who have a hand up, line should be open.
Yes, may I be heard?
Greetings, Mr. Demery Ford.
Yes, greetings, Gus, and greetings to the other callers and listeners. I want to first start off with the end of Chapter 10, because I wanted to bring up the fact, I was thinking if Mr. Brockway purposely rigged, you know, those gauges where it would cause the explosion. And after thinking about it more and looking at the text, when the pressure started to rise in the tank, he told the narrator to turn the white gauge. And I think he told him the wrong way because the pressure just kept increasing. And then it caused the explosion. And Brockway was already leaving the area when he knew that it was going to explode, and he left the young rookie who was learning down there to be injured. But I guess that answered my own question. And then it's really interesting how there were, you know, the two guys, Mr. Brockway and then Dr. Bledsoe, how similar they were in, you know, as so-called gatekeepers or whatever, but they were causing a form of death or trying to kill the narrator, whereas when Mr. Kilbrew or some of the other white people were practicing racism, that wasn't practicing racism to the degree that it would kill him or end his life. When he ended up in the hospital after the explosion, they were experimenting on him, and the conversations of the doctors talking about lobotomies, the shock treatment that they eventually did to him, brings to mind eugenics and Mary Sanger, when they were attempting to so-called cure the narrator, but they made some statements about his inferiority and his development, like the first caller pointed out, insinuating that he hasn't advanced to a state of human yet. So they did all these experiments on him and put him in a little box. I think that box was symbolizing the containment or the restriction that blacks and non-white people live in under the system of racism, white supremacy. Then there was a mention of Buckeye the Rabbit, which I think Burr Rabbit was probably one of the same, but the references to an animal, referencing himself to an animal, and the rabbit was, throughout literary, Burr Rabbit was like a trickster, some cunning, wiry little animal. So they was asking him questions, and that brought up his memory of childhood and had him relating to Buckeye the Rabbit like he himself was a rabbit. And then quickly, Miss Mary Rambo, the motherly figure that showed some kindness when he collapsed in the street, was showing some black community support, although in reality, there's no such thing as a black community. But I know for myself, as growing up in the rural South, I saw neighbors sharing food, helping unfortunate, less fortunate families, scholarships for young people, and even families allowing black young college students to live with their families to help with the cost of college. And I think her sense of compassion and her dedication to advancing a cause by investing in young black people is commendable. And then at last, I like to read the one quote, and he said, "I had no desire to destroy myself, even if I destroyed the machine." Did we get to that part yet, Gus? I don't want to.
Oh, we did get to that part.
Get a hint. Okay. "I had no desire to destroy myself, even if it destroyed the machine. I wanted freedom, not destruction. It was exhausting, but no matter what the scheme I conceived, there was one constant flaw, myself. There was no getting around it. I could no more escape than I could think of my identity. Perhaps I thought the two things were involved with one another. When I discover who I am, I'll be free," in chapter 11. And I believe that him, let's see, my thoughts on that, about the machine. The flaw, he could not get away. The way that the system of white supremacy is treating him, there was nothing wrong. He had no illness in the hospital other than the fact that, according to those doctors, he was black. And then everything that he's running into is behind the fact that he is black. And he's certainly suddenly beginning to realize that there's no getting around that, that no matter what identity he think he is, he'd always have that stigma of being black in this system. I mute my line. Thanks for taking the call, Gus.
Appreciate the commentary, Mr. Demery Four. That is a really important line, superbly written, but the paragraph where Ellison is, or the main character, yeah, Ellison, where he's describing the main character, where he says he was no Samson. He wanted freedom, not destruction. Wow. Red in Nevada, if you had commentary you wanted to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. I guess with this, I think like you were saying that we were on chapter 11, or I definitely thought that it was interesting, that part with the hospital, it kind of And if it was really, I think it was really nicely written. And of course, how the narrator was saying everything, just especially the part where they constantly kept asking him over and over again, you know, what is your name? What is your name? It kind of took me a while to understand just how, like when he was describing basically the experiment that they were doing on him. And it reminded me of medical apartheid. I don't know if that was somebody already mentioned that or not, but it kind of just, I cannot quite remember the part where I think one of the doctors or the men who were talking were basically like, well, why are you doing all this? And I'm sorry, I thought I had it kind of highlighted or whatever, but it definitely kind of made me think about, you know, this is what they like to do. They will kind of argue amongst themselves, but even if the one white man didn't kind of agree with the whole experimentation, he did nothing to stop it. And I think I heard, if that was Mr. Demery Ford, mention about the rabbit. And I know I've been mentioning before how he's kind of, you know, comparing himself to animals, or the Invisible Man was like kind of still having some type of comparison to himself and animals. There was also, so that might have been like at least a second or third time with an animal and himself. The other time was like Jack the Bear. And just, I thought it was fascinating how it was a factory hospital. I think that was one of the things that I highlighted. I'm not sure if we are on chapter 12 or not, but didn't have too much commentary about that. And also there's another reference about Robin, the picking of Robin Queen, I think, in that chapter, if I'm not mistaken. But that's all I have to share right now. Thank you for allowing me to speak.
There was indeed another reference to the Robin who had all of his feathers plucked clean, where I think he was referencing himself again. I think the first time that we heard the Robin being plucked clean, that was after he found out that Dr. Bledsoe did not hook him up with recommendations so that he could get a cool job, but simply wrote that he's never going to be coming back to the school, can't have a job, just keep this nigger boy running, basically. Same thing the grandfed had said. Anywho, and before I get to some of my comments, those references, Brer Rabbit, Brother Rabbit, or Buckeye Rabbit, and Brer Rabbit, and Jack the Bear, they are all from the collection of stories that are allegedly told by Uncle Remus, these folk tales that were collected, and Disney, the same Disney that brought us Black Panther. They put them together in Song of the South. I don't know if people have seen that. It doesn't get played as much because many whites have widely acknowledged that this is really racist, having some old nigger on a plantation tell a bunch of funny stories to a collection of white children. But these were the stories that Uncle Remus would tell. One of them was Buckeye Rabbit or Brer Rabbit, and the other Jack the Bear, and I think there's another one that's going to be coming as we continue with the book. But these were really, really, like Black Panther, like super popular stories, very racist stories, and these characters were often caricatures of Black people, racist stereotypes of Black people. I think Jack the Bear is kind of a dumb, slow-witted, lazy type of a character, and Buckeye the Rabbit is kind of thought of as a mischievous criminal character who's always getting into trouble type thing. Even though he's mischievous, he can get out of trouble, use his mind to trick you and get out of trouble and that sort of thing. But he is kind of thought of, you know, this criminal trickster, troublemaker type character. But I do think that's important, these references, as we move through the text. Other things that stood out, I'll keep my eye out for hands as I share some of the things that I know. I think the emphasis on the color white throughout his time at Liberty Paint Factory is important, but especially this scene, since we already had the person who started our book club, 6 years ago, Yorugu, Dr. Marimba Anise, and she was already invoked, I think she talks about, she has a whole chapter where she talks about, I don't have my library, flood. She has a whole chapter where she talks about whiteness and whites specifically when they come under the guise as being a scientist. This is in a paint factory. I'm going to take the position that none of these folks are doctors, that whites just do experiments. These could be the same folks who were talking about think this and think that down in the paint factory who just go upstairs and put on trade out their white paint overalls for a white coat and say, oh, now I can speak professional and, you know, we can do experiments on niggers. These folks, you know, I don't even think we should assume that they're doctors. The character is struggling with that. He's not even sure if they're doctors. They were in a paint factory. Why is this the factory hospital? He even talks about the strangeness of that. I think you all already talked about the significance of him not knowing his name and comparing that to black people, our void, collective void of knowledge as a result of white terrorism and that displacement. Just the way that they're talking to him, certainly medical apartheid and many other references that we've talked about. But when this person who may or may not be a doctor, again, I'm saying I don't think these folks are doctors. Hush, goddammit. One of the faces ordered, we're trying to get you started again. Now shut up. Dr. Kevorkian talked about this and saying he thinks the first time he was on the program, 2010, in the archives, he talked about this and saying that passage specifically, where another instance where he's not even a human. He's a robot. He's a machine of some sort. Even that language of we're trying to get you started again. That's the way that you would talk about a car generally. Not a person. That's not the type of language that you would typically hear in the ICU or an emergency room if it's a white person, you know, who is having some medical difficulties. He says, and even again, just the color white, where he's talked about all of this whiteness and seeing these people and he sees all the lights and what have you. He says, a freckled red-haired woman, to me, that's all code for white, in my view. You generally wouldn't have red-haired, freckled black people, but continuing, appeared. And then a man with a circular mirror attached to his forehead, a doctor. Yes, he was a doctor, and the women were nurses. It was coming clear. I was in a hospital. They would care for me. It was all geared toward the easing of pain. I felt thankful. Confusion is lethal. Lots of assumptions being made here. And just in general with whites, very rarely, if ever, are they coming to help niggers unless they've got some sort of ulterior objective that you don't know about. But his confusion and thinking, oh, these folks are going to look out for me, even that they're doctors again. Who knows? They're just wearing white. He continues, the castration. Again, this book was published in 1952, 3 years before the castration and lynching of Emmett Till. Super important context, I think, for this scene and the way that they're talking. That was huge. I think we already had a super important reference to the eugenics movement, which was hugely popular 1920s. This is exactly what they wanted to do. Forget, you know, just the lobotomy. Let's do some snipping. Let's make sure that these Lothrop Stoddard, the rising tide of color against white world supremacy. We do not want any Negro babies. Let's get cracking. We have talked about that extensively on this program and their efforts to sterilize black females and castrations of black males, all the way including Emmett Till. Long undeniable record of that sort of behavior in him, including it here. Thought super important as well. Them calling him boy throughout this portion of the text, I thought was really important, especially even when they got towards the end, when he's about to leave the paint factory and he's told, even within the same sentence, he's told, well, boy, it looks as though you're cured. One of them said, you're a new man. The contradiction from the same person right within the same sentence. The original, I submit, is they know what it is, boy. And they're just saying that because you're a new boy would have been the way. But, you know, nobody says that. So we're just going to say it the way we're accustomed to saying it. Knowing we're talking to a nigra. Wow. The portion that I highlighted, I did not know that this portion of the text was going to be included this week. I've read this book many times, but I haven't memorized like the exact placement of every paragraph. The audio segment I played at the beginning from one of Ellison's biographers, where he discussed the rage in Ellison's writing and saying that he felt he was angry studying his life and writing about him, that he was angry specifically about being a victim of white supremacy. And that anger, you could see it throughout his life. You can see it in his writing. Man, that passage from chapter 11, where he says, "And suddenly my bewilderment suspended and I wanted to be angry, murderously angry." His biographer, he talked about how Ellison said he was angry, angry enough that he could kill somebody. He remembered the point in his life where he said, "Wow, I'm big enough, I'm strong enough that I could kill somebody. I'm angry enough to kill somebody. Let me start this paragraph over. I wanted to be angry, murderously angry, but somehow the pulse of current smashing through my body prevented me. Something had been disconnected. For though I had seldom used my capacities for anger and indignation, I had no doubt that I possessed them. And like a man who knows that he must fight, whether angry or not, when called a son of a bitch, I tried to imagine myself angry, only to discover a deeper sense of remoteness. I was beyond anger. I was only bewildered. And those above seemed to sense it. There was no avoiding the shock, and I rolled with the agitated tide out into the blackness." Woo! The brilliance of Ralph Ellison. What to say? But I think that is an extraordinary passage. I would be stunned if every person listening to the broadcast right now, live or archived, can't think of at least one time where that has been your experience in the system of white supremacy, where you know I should be upset because of what they've done to me, but I'm having a difficult time for whatever reason being angry, acting on that anger. It has somehow been disconnected. I am very, very sure if you stop and think, you can probably think of an incident. And I think that's part of the confusion. When you get confused about why something has happened, what's going on, you don't quite grasp even how this started because it was some sort of unprovoked act of white terrorism. That confusion can frequently disrupt being justifiably angry about what has happened to us as victims of racism. I do have other notes, but I think that passage right there is, wow, all the way to the end, particularly in a paragraph or in a chapter, this is all chapter 11, in a chapter that almost every paragraph, every other sentence is emphasizing the whiteness of this environment, the white clothing, and they're even wearing white overalls and the white people. Everything about this environment is just drowning. He's being smothered in whiteness, except in this moment, where he cannot be angry. He should be angry, but he cannot find that anger, and he is shocked, and he just drifts out into blackness. Do any folks have any thoughts on this particular paragraph specifically, or even own experiences of, I should have been angry, but for whatever reason, it got interrupted? No thoughts on that paragraph?
May I be heard?
Read in Nevada.
Yes, I guess I maybe overlooked or didn't, like I said, didn't really fully grasp the gravity of that paragraph, but it does make a lot of sense. And it definitely kind of falls in line with just the previous parts of the book where, you know, just constantly comparing like dark or blackness to, you know, anger or something bad. But I feel like at that point, it's not, I don't think it is referenced as the dark part is being referenced so negatively as it is like linked to like a bad anger. Maybe it's like a justifiable anger. And I mean, of course, like, you know, I've experienced that, especially if you're surrounded by nothing but racists and, you know, you can get angry, but then really not knowing you know, what the next step should be after, maybe if you were to act out your anger, murderous or not. But another thing, I guess, that I remembered when you pointed out the fact of the nurses is, you know, just with our confusion, still as crafty as racists have been, to really think that we can rely on the female racist counterpart. And that's something that I guess is like the recurring theme in the book. And just kind of now it makes me think about in my past, you know, looking at white teachers or of course white nurses and white female nurses, what have you, in thinking that they are there to help. And yet they don't stand, they still, you know, are still standing aside while all this is going on. And I'll mute my line. Thank you for allowing me to share again.
Appreciate that, Red. Any other thoughts on that passage? Brilliant passage. I would encourage folks, even if you don't have thoughts now, to maybe go back and reread it. It's amazing. Any other thoughts?
Yes, I have some thoughts on that, Gus. There are lots of incidents that I can remember where a couple of them, well, one is really funny. I went to a doctor and I had a condition that was known as a trigger finger. It's where, you know, your joints start to pop and it's very annoying. So I went in and what they do is give you a shot, a cortisone shot or whatever, fix it. But I needed an excuse for work, so I had her to write up an excuse. And when she wrote it up, she put down nigger finger, you know. And I needed the excuse. So I just went on with it. But I wanted to go back in there and actually, you know, confront this doctor about the way this is written. I know that it's hard to read the doctor's writing, but come on now. It's a big difference in a T and an N. But that's one answer. And, you know, one way you may be new on the job and you know something is wrong, you're being mistreated, you don't want to say anything because you don't want to get off on the wrong foot. You may put up with a lot of unnecessary mistreatment because you just want to keep a low profile and you don't want so-called to, you know, be known as a agitator or a troublemaker. I mute my line.
Or I think. other folks who dialed in, if you have commentary either on that passage or if you have other thoughts to share on the text, line should be open.
I just wanted to contribute real quick, if I could. If I may ask, though, can you repeat the gist of the passage? I was hearing a little bit, but I actually got engaged in something else. So what I'm getting is that it has to do with being summoning your anger, right, at a time when it's appropriate toward whites. Is that right?
He says, I wanted to be angry, murderously angry, but somehow the pulse of current smashing through my body prevented me. Something had been disconnected. For though I had seldom used my capacities for anger and indignation, I had no doubt that I possessed them, and like a man who knows that he must fight, whether angry or not, when called a son of a bitch, I tried to imagine myself angry, only to discover a deeper sense of remoteness. I was beyond anger. I was only bewildered, and those above seemed to sense it. There was no avoiding the shock, and I rolled with the agitated tide out into the blackness. That is the passage.
No, I don't have anything. That's just a lot. That's a lot to think about right away. But I'm angry all the time, so I don't feel as remote yet. But I definitely share a lust for anger, if I could use that word, or a good familiarity with anger. And that's all I'll say about that.
Right on. Appreciate that. The doctors being above him. medical apartheid been mentioned many times. If folks remember, there was a passage where that was around the same time period and earlier 1920s, where that was the rage, that was the entertainment. Whites would go and watch Negroes be butchered for fun. Not lynchings I'm talking about. I'm talking about like in a hospital setting, like what we are reading. Well, this is not a hospital. This is a factory. But yeah, they would go to hospital settings, or maybe they would go to the paint factory and watch Negroes be tortured. I think Sam, he had his jaw cut or removed in medical apartheid. That was a whole big chunk. Harriet A. Washington, top five, right alongside Ellison's Invisible Man. I also think from this, the passage that I just read, which is in 11, the main character has not shown an unwillingness to be angry with black people. He just fought with Lucius Brockway last week. That's where we ended at, right? He was wouldn't even let him pick up his fake teeth after the brawl was over. He got mad at Dr. Bledsoe and was willing to confront him. He had cursed the vet and lots of black people throughout the book who had got on his nerves. I think this might be the first time that he's even hinted at being angry at a white person in the book. He's talked, you know, he's shown his anger, his rage with black characters throughout the text. I don't remember him being upset with a white person ever. Do you all remember? Am I messing up here? Do you all remember him being upset with a white person previously in the text? I guess he got a little upset with the younger Emerson when they were talking last week before he gave him the letter. But I mean, it was nothing like nothing like his frustration with Bledsoe, his frustration with Lucius Brockway, where he called him all kinds of handkerchief head mammies and everything else that he said. He tried to think of every nasty name he could think of to call Lucius Brockway last week. Do you all remember him being upset with a white person previously?
At the beginning of the book, he wanted to murder a white man.
Oh, but that's at the end. That's at the end. That is a good point, but that's at the end. That's not in the trajectory, the chronology of the text, right? Walking from the battle royal to where we are now. That's technically at the end, but yeah, that would count, I guess. Any others? Yeah, I think this might be the first time. If you think of one, like I said, it did seem he got a little frustrated and impatient with the younger Emerson before he, you know, kind of showed him what Dr. Bledsoe had said and everything. But I think this might be the first time that he is murderously angry, as he said, with a white person, and he has difficulty. That, I think, is important. I have seen where black people, we have no problem. We will rumble with a Lucius Brockway, and I'm talking Gus T. Renning, all of us. That's how we've been programmed. We will get down with a Lucius Brockway anytime. You said, what did you call me? Let's get down. One of these whites who are doing all kinds of things to us, threatening castration and the whole nine? Not quite as ready to rumble. If I'm talking crazy, feel free to point that out. A person that dialed in 9749, did you have commentary?
The commentary I was going to make, I think Demi Ford already stated it. Also, I was going to say he did get angry last week when he was going for that, when he wanted to meet with Mr. Emerson. He did get angry at that white man. So that's another incident of that.
I just mentioned that, I think, two or three times. I said he did get frustrated. He did get a little impatient with the younger
Emerson. I missed that. I'm just not getting on the call, so I missed it. I didn't hear you when you said that. Just got on the call.
Oh, right on. No worries. We're in agreement, though. I did say that last week. I specified his frustration with the younger Emerson last week. I do not think it was on the same level with the anger that he's shown to black characters throughout the text. The young black boys at the Battle Royal, Dr. Bledsoe, Lucius Brockway. I think he's been way more angry at the vet at the Golden Day, way more angry at the black characters than any white people. This is the most anger I think we've seen in a white person thus far, except for a moment with Mr. Emerson. The caller at 8961, did you have commentary?
Yes. May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Basically, I completely agree. I've actually had that situation happen to me during the week, with a client where she made a comment about basically a quote unquote woman that classifies herself as white, basically stated to me, you know, I use my standing desk during the after lunch because sometimes I get the itis. And I froze because I wanted to respond, but I knew anything that was going to come out of my mouth or any action at that moment would have been detrimental to my job. So I had to pull back a little bit from the scenario. And I think she realized that by the look on my face and then quickly made a kind of like fake apology and, oh, I'm sorry about that. I know the word is not good. I shouldn't say that. I'm sorry. And kind of then went on to jump to another conversation as if she never insulted me right to my face. So I think what ends up happening is maybe one or two things, which is we do go to a dark place when that happens because we can't let out the rage. But at the same time, figuring out the words and how to address scenarios that come up, it's pretty much being on guard all the time when you're around white people and non-white people sometimes. And that, I think, is what is difficult for anybody to deal with. And that's what I see from that writing, is just that he doesn't know how to handle that at that moment because it's the first time it happened to him. That being said, I'll mute my line.
Bewildered. That was the language that he used in describing his anger and then bewildered. We have about 5 minutes before we get to the second audio clip. Did we miss any, or even if we didn't, anybody have anything else that they wanted to share? Any other comments, observations, questions, confused about anything?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Did we get through chapter 12, or are we in chapter 12?
We are in chapter 12. We have a little ways to go. We stopped where he went to sleep right after Mary naps him off the street, says, come back. He resists and then he goes to sleep. That's where we stopped at. And we'll pick up at that part of chapter 12 when we continue.
Okay. So just a couple comments on the first part of chapter 12. I thought it was interesting how still like in his more confused state in the beginning where he says there were two huge women with spoiled cream complexions seemed to struggle with their massive bodies as they came past. And I thought that was interesting because, you know, it's, I'm assuming with spoiled cream and he's saying huge and struggled, maybe he might be considered, maybe that might be describing someone non-black, and definitely kind of plays into when we're more confused that, you know, basically anything black, if it's huge or what have you, is automatically kind of gives you a sense of disgust. And that's not quite how he, I forgot what chapter it was when he was just going up to New York, how he described that huge, possibly disgusting white woman with the big nasty mole. Then there was, I think this might still be in the part where we're still where we might have left off. I didn't know what au fait was, and I think that was a term that might have been used maybe in the previous chapter. It was one sentence where basically it's Mary's always helping someone and you need some help because here you black as me and as white as a sheet, as the au fait would say, watch these steps. So I didn't know what au fait was, and so I guess that's just like another derogatory term for white people. And then around that same portion, there's also a part where he's describing, like, I guess the help. And I think Mr. Demery Ford has said something kind of about this too, where Miss Mary is helping and, you know, it is really nice, but it's still kind of like, he doesn't really call her Miss Mary, despite the fact that this is like one of the only people who is really showing him like a genuine help. But at the there's this part where he says, if I don't think I'm sinking, look at the hole that I'm in. And I thought that that was interesting, to where even if we are getting help from black people, it might be, you know, maybe not the best place or what have you, but they're still helping us, but we still consider it. It's still kind of like anti-black. It's still, you know, I'm being helped, but I'm in the hood and look at the terrible predicament, you know, look at this horrible place that I'm in, basically. And I'll mute my line. Thank you.
Wow. That word, au fait, it's Pig Latin for foe, F-O-E. Going back, I think, centuries, where blacks were intelligent enough to recognize an enemy when they saw one and were codified enough to figure out a way so that they could communicate that amongst themselves and to the best of their ability to try to keep that information from whites, that they recognize these are our enemies. But yeah, that's Pig Latin for foe. And I know that from the book club, you got that word's been used in a few of the texts. Malcolm X's autobiography was one of the texts from a couple years back where it came up in that chunk of the etymology came out. Any other comments, questions, folks wanted to share?
Yes. Gus, I believe that the doctors inside of the hospital, when they were addressing the narrator as though he was a child, with all the little simple statements and the questions about the nursery rhymes and the fairy tale, it just all had this condescending, childlike, you know, communication going on.
Absolutely. Throughout the entirety of it, really throughout the entirety of the book thus far, I would say that that pattern holds. Absolutely. With that, we will go ahead and get started. Now, we're still in chapter 12. Presumably, the narrator should be waking up at Mary's residence. If you have questions or comments that you didn't get to share, just make note and we should have ample time to share once the second audio segment concludes. Context of White Supremacy, the brilliant Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man, audio segment number 2.
I saw her across the room when I awoke, reading a newspaper, her glasses low across the bridge of her nose as she stared at the page intently. Then I realized that though the glasses still slanted down, the eyes were no longer focused on the page, but on my face, and lighting with a slow smile. "How you feel now?" she said. "Much better. I thought you would be. And you'll be even better after you have a cup of soup I got for you in the kitchen. You slept a good long time." "Did I?" I said. "What time is it?" "It's about 10 o'clock. And from the way you slept, I suspects all you needed was some rest." "No, don't get up yet. You got to drink your soup. Then you can go," she said, leaving. She returned with a bowl and a plate. "This here'll fix you up," she said. "You don't get this kind of service up there at Men's House, do you? Now you just sit there and take your time. I ain't got nothing to do but read the paper, and I like the company. You have to make time in the morning?" "No, I've been sick," I said, "but I have to look for a job." "I knowed you wasn't well. Why you try to hide it?" I didn't want to be trouble to anyone," I said. "Everybody has to be trouble to somebody, and you just come from the hospital, too?" I looked up. She sat in the rocking chair, bent forward, her arms folded at ease across her aproned lap. Had she searched my pockets? "How did you know that?" I said. "There you go getting suspicious," she said sternly. "That's what's wrong with the world today. Don't nobody trust nobody. I can smell that hospital smell on you, son. You got enough ether in those clothes to put to sleep a dog." I couldn't remember telling you that I'd been in the hospital. "No, and you didn't have to. I smelled that out. You got people here in the city?" "No, ma'am," I said. "They're down south. I came up here to work so I could go to school, and I got sick. Now, ain't that too bad? But you make out all right. What do you plan to make out of yourself?" "I don't know now. I came here wanting to be an educator. Now, I don't know." "What's wrong with being an educator?" I thought about it while sipping the good hot soup. "Nothing, I suppose. I just think I'd like to do something else." "Well, whatever it is, I hope it's something that's a credit to the race." "I hope so," I said. "Don't hope. Make it that way." I looked at her, thinking of what I'd tried to do and of where it had gotten me, seeing her heavy, composed figure before me. It's you young folks what's going to make the changes, she says. Y'all's the ones. You got to lead and you got to fight and move us all on up a little higher. And I tell you something else. It's the ones from the South that's got to do it. Them what knows the fire and ain't forgot how it burns. Up here, too many forgets. They finds a place for theyselves and forgets the ones on the bottom. Oh, a heap of them talks about doing things, but they done really forgot. No, it's you young ones what has to remember and take the lead. Yes, I said. And you have to take care of yourself, son. Don't let this Harlem get you. I'm in New York, but New York ain't in me. Understand what I mean? Don't get corrupted. I won't. I'll be too busy. All right, now. You looks to me like you might make something out of yourself, so you be careful. I got up to go, watching her raise herself out of her chair and come with me to the door. You ever decide you want a room somewhere beside Men's House, try me, she said. The rent's reasonable. I'll remember that, I said. I was to remember sooner than I had thought. The moment I entered the bright, buzzing lobby of Men's House, I was overcome by a sense of alienation and hostility. My overalls were causing stares, and I knew that I could live there no longer, that that phase of my life was past. The lobby was the meeting place for various groups still caught up in the illusions that had just been boomeranged out of my head. College boys working to return to school down south. Older advocates of racial progress with utopian schemes for building black business empires. Preachers, ordained by no authority except their own, without church or congregation, without bread or wine, body or blood. The community leaders without followers. Old men of 60 or more still caught up in post-Civil War dreams of freedom within segregation. The pathetic ones who possessed nothing beyond their dreams of being gentlemen, who held small jobs or drew small pensions, and all pretending to be engaged in some vast, though obscure, enterprise, who affected the pseudo-courtly manners of certain Southern congressmen and bowed and nodded as they passed like senile old roosters in a barnyard. The younger crowd, for whom I now felt a contempt such as only a disillusioned dreamer feels for those still unaware that they dream. The business students from Southern colleges for whom business was a vague, abstract game with rules as obsolete as Noah's Ark, but who yet were drunk on finance. Yes, and the older group with similar aspirations, the fundamentalists, the actors who sought to achieve the status of brokers through imagination alone. A group of janitors and messengers who spent most of their wages on clothing such as was fashionable among Wall Street brokers with their Brooks Brothers suits and bowler hats, English umbrellas, black calfskin shoes and yellow gloves, with their orthodox and passionate argument as to what was the correct tie to wear, with what shirt, what shade of gray was correct for spats, and what would the Prince of Wales wear to a certain seasonal event. Should field glasses be slung from the right or from the left shoulder? Who never read the financial pages, though they purchased the Wall Street Journal religiously and carried it beneath their left elbow, pressed firm against the body and grasped in the left hand, always manicured and gloved, fair weather or foul, with an easy precision. Oh, they had style. While the other hand whipped a tightly rolled umbrella back and forth at a calculated angle, with their Hamburgs and Chesterfields, their polo coats and Tyrolean hats worn strictly as fashion demanded. I could feel their eyes, saw them all, and saw, too, the time when they would know that my prospects were ended, and saw already the contempt they'd feel for me, a college man who had lost his prospects and pride. I could see it all. And I knew that even the officials and the older men would despise me as though somehow in losing my place in Bledsoe's world I had betrayed them. I saw it as they looked at my overalls. I had started toward the elevator when I heard the voice, raised in laughter, and turned to see him, holding forth to a group in the lobby chairs and saw the rolls of fat behind the wrinkled, high-domed, close-cut head, and I was certain that it was he, and stooped without thought and lifted its shining full and foul and moved forward two long steps, dumping its great brown transparent splash upon the head, warned too late by someone across the room, and too late for me to see that it was not Bledsoe, but a preacher, a prominent Baptist, who shot up wide-eyed with disbelief and outrage, and I shot around and out of the lobby before anyone could think to stop me. No one followed me, and I wandered the streets amazed at my own action. Later it began to rain, and I sneaked back near Men's House and persuaded an amused porter to slip my things out to me. I learned that I had been barred from the building for 99 years and a day.
"You might not can come back, man," the porter said, "but after what you did, I swear they never will stop talking about you. You really baptized the old Rev."
So that same night, I went back to Mary's, where I lived in a small but comfortable room until the ice came. It was a period of quietness. I paid my way with my compensation money and found living with her pleasant, except for her constant talk about leadership and responsibility. And even this was not too bad as long as I could pay my way. It was, however, a small compensation. And when after several months my money ran out and I was looking again for a job, I found her exceedingly irritating to listen to. Still, she never dunned me and was as generous with her servings of food during mealtime as ever.
"It's just hard times you're going through," she'd say. "Everybody worth his salt has his hard times. And when you get to be somebody, you'll see these here very same hard times helped you a heap."
I didn't see it that way. I had lost my sense of direction. I spent my time, when not looking for work, in my room where I read countless books from the library. Sometimes, when there was still money or when I had earned a few dollars waiting table, I'd eat out and wander the streets until late at night. Other than Mary, I had no friends and desired none. Nor did I think of Mary as a friend. She was something more, a force, a stable, familiar force, like something out of my past which kept me from whirling off into some unknown which I dared not face. It was a most painful position, for at the same time Mary reminded me constantly that something was expected of me, some act of leadership, some newsworthy achievement, and I was torn between resenting her for it and loving her for the nebulous hope she kept alive. I had no doubt that I could do something, but what? And how? I had no context, and I believed in nothing. And the obsession with my identity, which I had developed in the factory hospital, returned with a vengeance. Who was I? How had I come to be? Certainly I couldn't help being different from when I left the campus, but now a new, painful, contradictory voice had grown up within me, and between its demands for revengeful action and Mary's silent pressure, I throbbed with guilt and puzzlement. I wanted peace and quiet, tranquility, but was too much a boil inside. Somewhere beneath the load of the emotion-freezing ice which my life had conditioned my brain to produce, a spot of black anger glowed and threw off a hot red light of such intensity that, had Lord Kelvin known of its existence, he would have had to revise his measurements. A remote explosion had occurred somewhere, perhaps back at Emerson's or that night in Bledsoe's office, and it had caused the ice cap to melt and shift the slightest bit. But that bit, that fraction, was irrevocable. Coming to New York had perhaps been an unconscious attempt to keep the old freezing unit going, but it hadn't worked. Hot water had gotten into its coils. Only a drop, perhaps, but that drop was the first wave of the deluge. One moment I believed I was dedicated, willing to lie on the blazing coals, do anything to attain a position on the campus. Then, snap! It was done with, finished, through. Now there was only the problem of forgetting it. If only all the contradictory voices shouting inside my head would calm down and sing a song in unison. Whatever it was, I wouldn't care as long as they sang without dissonance. Yes. And avoided the uncertain extremes of the scale. But there was no relief. I was wild with resentment, but too much under self-control, that frozen virtue, that freezing vice. And the more resentful I became, the more my old urge to make speeches returned. While walking along the streets, words would spill from my lips in a mumble over which I had little control. I became afraid of what I might do. All things were indeed awash in my mind. I longed for home. And while the ice was melting to form a flood in which I threatened to drown, I awoke one afternoon to find that my first northern winter had set. At first, I had turned away from the window and tried to read, but my mind kept wandering back to my old problems, and unable to endure it any longer, I rushed from the house, extremely agitated, but determined to get away from my hot thoughts into the chill air. At the entrance, I bumped against a woman who called me a filthy name, only causing me to increase my speed. In a few minutes, I was several blocks away, having moved to the next avenue and downtown. The streets were covered with ice and soot-flecked snow, and from above, a feeble sun filtered through the haze. I walked with my head down, feeling the biting air, and yet I was hot, burning with an inner fever. I barely raised my eyes until a car, passing with a thudding of skid chains, whirled completely around on the ice, then turned cautiously and thudded off again. I walked slowly on, blinking my eyes in the chill air, my mind a blur with the hot inner argument continuing. The whole of Harlem seemed to fall apart in the swirl of snow. I imagined I was lost, and for a moment there was an eerie quiet. I imagined I heard the fall of snow upon snow. What did it mean? I walked, my eyes focused into the endless succession of barbershops, beauty parlors, confectionaries, luncheonettes, fish houses, and hogmaw joints. Walking close to the windows, the snowflakes lacing swift between, simultaneously forming a curtain of veil and stripping it aside. A flash of red and gold from a window filled with religious articles caught my eye, and behind the film of frost etching the glass, I saw two brashly painted plaster images of Mary and Jesus surrounded by dream books, love powders, God is love signs, money drawing oil, and plastic dice. A black statue of a nude Nubian slave grinned out at me from beneath a turban of gold. I passed on to a window decorated with switches of wiry false hair, ointments guaranteed to produce the miracle of whitening black skin. You too can be truly beautiful, a sign proclaimed. Win greater happiness with whiter complexion. Be outstanding in your social set. I hurried on, suppressing a savage urge to push my fist through the pane. A wind was rising, the snow thinning. Where would I go? To a movie? Could I sleep there? I ignored the windows now and walked along, becoming aware that I was muttering to myself again. Then, far down at the corner, I saw an old man warming his hands against the sides of an odd-looking wagon, from which a stovepipe reeled off a thin spiral of smoke that drifted the odor of baking yams slowly to me, bringing a stab of swift nostalgia. I stopped as though struck by a shot, deeply inhaling, remembering, my mind surging back, back. At home, we'd bake them in the hot coals of the fireplace, had carried them cold to school for lunch, munched them secretly, squeezing the sweet pulp from the soft peel as we hid from the teacher behind the largest book, the world's geography. Yes, and we'd love them candied or baked in a cobbler. Deep fat fried in a pocket of dough or roasted with pork and glazed, ooh, with the well-browned fat. Had chewed them raw, yams, and years ago. More yams than years ago. Though the time seemed endlessly expanded, stretched thin as the spiraling smoke beyond all recall. I moved again. "Get your hot-baked Carolina yam," he called. At the corner, the old man, wrapped in an army overcoat, his feet covered with gunny sacks, his head in a knitted cap, was puttering with a stack of paper bags. I saw a crude sign on the side of the wagon proclaiming, "Yams," as I walked flush into the warmth thrown by the coals that glowed in a grate underneath. "How much are your yams?" I said, suddenly hungry. "They 10 cents and they sweet," he said, his voice quavering with age. "These ain't none of them binding ones, neither. These here is real sweet yellow yams. How many?" "One," I said. "If they're that good, one should be enough." He gave me a searching glance. There was a tear in the corner of his eye. He chuckled and opened the door of the improvised oven, reaching gingerly with his gloved hand. The yam, some bubbling with syrup, lay on a wire rack above glowing coals that leaped to low blue flame when struck by the draft of air. The flash of warmth set my face aglow as he removed one of the yams and shut the door. "Here you are, sir," he said, starting to put the yam into a bag. "Never mind the bag. I'm going to eat it. Here." "Thanks." He took the dime. "If that ain't a sweet one, I'll give you another one, free of charge." I knew that it was sweet before I broke it. Bubbles of brown syrup had burst the skin. "Go ahead and break it," the old man said. "Break it, and I'll give you some butter, since you're going to eat it right here. And lots of folks take some home. They got their own butter at home." I broke it, seeing the sugary pulp steaming in the cold. "Hold it over here," he said. He took a crock from a rack on the side of the wagon. "Right here." I held it, watching him pour a spoonful of melted butter over the yam and the butter seeping in. "Thanks." "You welcome. I tell you something." "What's that?" I said. "If that ain't the best eating you had in a long time, I give you your money back." "You don't have to convince me," I said. "I can look at it and see it's good." "You right, but everything what looks good ain't necessarily good," he said. "But these is." I took a bite, finding it as sweet and hot as any I'd ever had, and was overcome with such a surge of homesickness that I turned away to keep my control. I walked along, munching the yam, just as suddenly overcome by an intense feeling of freedom, simply because I was eating while walking along the street. It was exhilarating. I no longer had to worry about who saw me or about what was proper. To hell with all that, and as sweet as the yam actually was, it became like nectar with the thought. If only someone who had known me at school or at home would come along and see me now. How shocked they'd be. I'd push them into a side street and smear their faces with the peel. What a group of people we were, I thought. Why, you could cause us the greatest humiliation simply by confronting us with something we liked. Not all of us, but so many. Simply by walking up and shaking a set of chitterlings or a well-boiled hog maw at them during the clear light of day. What consternation it would cause. and I saw myself advancing upon Bledsoe, standing bare of his false humility in the crowded lobby of Men's House, and seeing him there, and seeing me, and ignoring me, and me enraged, and suddenly whipping out a foot or two of chitterlings, raw, uncleaned, and dripping sticky circles on the floor as I shake them in his face, shouting, "Bledsoe, you're a shameless chitterling eater. I accuse you of relishing hog bowel." And not only do you eat them, you sneak and eat them in private when you think you're unobserved. You're a sneaking chitterling lover. I accuse you of indulging in a filthy habit, Bledsoe. Lug them out of there, Bledsoe. Lug them out so we can see. I accuse you before the eyes of the world. And he lugs them out, yards of them with mustard greens and racks of pig's ears and pork chops and black-eyed peas with dull, accusing eyes. I let out a wild laugh, almost choking over the yam as the scene spun before me. Why, with others present, it would be worse than if I had accused him of raping an old woman of 99 years, weighing 90 pounds, blind in one eye and lame in the hip. Bledsoe would disintegrate, disinflate with a profound sigh. He'd drop his head in shame. He'd lose caste. The weekly newspapers would attack him. The captions over his picture, "Prominent Educator Reverts to Field Niggerism." His rivals would denounce him as a bad example for the youth. Editorials would demand that he either recant or retire from public life. In the South, his white folks would desert him. He would be discussed far and wide, and all the trustees' money couldn't prop up his sagging prestige. He'd end up an exile washing dishes at the automat. For down South, he'd be unable to get a job on the honey wagon. This is all very wild and childish, I thought, but to hell with being ashamed of what you liked. No more of that for me. I am what I am. I wolfed down the yam and ran back to the old man and handed him 20 cents. "Give me 2 more, I said. "Sure, oh, you won't. As long as I got 'em, I can see you a serious yam eater, young fella. You eating them right away?" "As soon as you give them to me," I said. "You want 'em butted? Please." "Sure, that way you can get the most out of 'em." "Yes, sir," he said, handing over the yams. "I can see you one of these old-fashioned yam eaters." "They're my birthmark," I said. "I yam what I am." "Then you must be from South Carolina," he said with a grin. "South Carolina, nothing. Where I come from, we really go for yams." "Come back tonight or tomorrow if you can eat some more," he called after me. "My old lady be out here with some hot, sweet potato fried pies." Hot fried pies, I thought sadly, moving away. I would probably have indigestion if I ate one. Now that I no longer felt ashamed of the things I always loved, I probably could no longer digest very many of them. What and how much had I lost by trying to do only what was expected of me, instead of what I myself had wished to do? What a waste. What a senseless waste. But what of those things which you actually didn't like? Not because you were not supposed to like them. Not because to dislike them was considered a mark of refinement and education. But because you actually found them distasteful. The very idea annoyed me. How could you know? It involved a problem of choice. I would have to weigh many things carefully before deciding. And there would be some things that would cause quite a bit of trouble, simply because I had never formed a personal attitude toward so much. I had accepted the accepted attitudes, and it had made life seem simple. But not yams. I had no problem concerning them, and I would eat them whenever and wherever I took the notion. Continue on the yam level, and life would be sweet, though somewhat yellowish. Yet the freedom to eat yams on the street was far less than I had expected upon coming to the city. An unpleasant taste bloomed in my mouth now as I bit the end of the yam and threw it into the street. It had been frostbitten. The wind drove me into a side street where a group of boys had set a packing box afire. The gray smoke hung low and seemed to thicken as I walked with my head down and eyes closed, trying to avoid the fumes. My lungs began to pain, then, emerging, wiping my eyes and coughing, I almost stumbled over it. It was piled in a jumble along the walk and over the curb, into the street like a lot of junk, waiting to be hauled away. Then I saw the sullen-faced crowd, looking at a building where two white men were toting out a chair in which an old woman sat, who, as I watched, struck at them feebly with her fists. A motherly-looking old woman with her head tied in a handkerchief, wearing a man's shoes and a man's heavy blue sweater. It was startling. The crowd watching silently, the two white men lugging the chair and trying to dodge the blows, and the old woman's face streaming with angry tears as she thrashed at them with her fists. I couldn't believe it. Something, a sense of foreboding, filled me, a quick sense of uncleanliness. "Leave us alone," she cried. "Leave us alone," as the men pulled their heads out of range and sat her down abruptly at the curb, hurrying back into the building. What on earth, I thought, looking above me. What on earth? The old woman sobbed, pointing to the stuff piled along the curb. "Just look at what they're doing to us. Just look," looking straight at me. And I realized that what I taken for junk was actually worn household furnishings. "Just look at what they're doing," she said, her teary eyes upon my face. I looked away, embarrassed, staring into the rapidly growing crowd. Faces were peering sullenly from the windows above, and now, as the two men reappeared at the top of the steps carrying a battered chest of drawers, I saw a third man come out and stand behind them, pulling at his ear as he looked out over the crowd.
"Shake it up, you fellas," he said. "Shake it up. We don't have all day."
Then the men came down with the chest, and I saw the crowd give way sullenly, the men trudging through, grunting and putting the chest at the curb, then returning into the building without a glance to left or right.
"Look at that," a slender man near me said. "We ought to beat the hell out those paddies."
I looked silently into his face, taut and ashy in the cold, his eyes trained upon the men going up the steps.
"Sure, we ought to stop 'em," another man said, "but ain't that much nerve in the whole bunch." "There's plenty nerve," the slender man said. "All they need is someone to set it off. All they need is a leader." "You mean you don't have the nerve?" "Who, me?" the man said. "Who, me? Yes, you."
"Just look," the old woman said. "Just look." Her face still turned toward mine. I turned away, edging closer to the two men. "Who are those men?" I said, edging closer.
"Marshals or something. I don't give a damn who they is."
"Marshals, hell," another man said. "Those guys doing all the toting ain't nothing but trustees. Soon as they get through, they lock 'em up again."
"I don't care who they are. They got no business putting these old folks out on the sidewalk."
"You mean they're putting them out of their apartment?" I said. "They can do that up here?"
"Man, where you from?" he said, swinging toward me. "What does it look they putting them out of? A Pullman car? They being evicted."
I was embarrassed. Others were turning to stare. I had never seen an eviction. Someone snickered.
"Where did he come from?"
A flash of heat went over me, and I turned. "Look, friend," I said, hearing a hot edge coming into my voice, "I asked a civil question. If you don't care to answer, don't. But don't try to make me look ridiculous."
"Ridiculous, hell. All scobos is ridiculous. Who the hell is you?"
"Never mind. I am who I am. Just don't beat up your gums at me," I said, throwing him a newly acquired phrase. Just then, one of the men came down the steps with an armful of articles, and I saw the old woman reach up, yelling,
"Take your hands off my Bible!"
And the crowd surged forward. The white man's hot eyes swept the crowd.
"Where, lady?" he said. "I don't see any Bible."
and I saw her snatch the book from his arms, clutching it fiercely and sending forth a shriek. "They can come in your home and do what they want to you," she said. "Just come stomping and jerk your life up by the roots. But this here's the last straw. They ain't gonna bother with my Bible." The white man eyed the crowd. "Look, lady," he said, more to the rest of us than to her, "I don't want to do this. I have to. They sent me up here to do it. If it was left to me, you could stay here till hell freezes over."
These white folks, Lord, these white folks,"
she moaned, her eyes turned toward the sky as an old man pushed past me and went to her. Hun, he said, placing his hand on her shoulder. It's the agent, not these gentlemen. He's the one. He says it's the bank, but you know he's the one. We've done business with him for over 20 years.
"Don't tell me," she said. "It's all the white folks, not just one. They all against us. Every stinking, low-down one of them."
"She's right," a hoarse voice said. "She's right. They all is."
Something had been working fiercely inside of me, and for a moment I had forgotten the rest of the crowd. Now I recognized the self-consciousness about them, as though we were ashamed to witness the eviction, as though we were all unwilling intruders upon some shameful event, and thus we were careful not to touch or stare too hard at the effects that lined the curb. For we were witnesses of what we did not wish to see, though curious, fascinated, despite our shame, and through it all, the old female, mind-plunging, crying. I looked at the old people, feeling my eyes burn, my throat tighten. The old woman's sobbing was having a strange effect upon me, as when a child, seeing the tears of its parents, is moved by both fear and sympathy to cry. I turned away, feeling myself being drawn to the old couple by a warm, dark, rising whirlpool of emotion which I feared. I was wary of what the sight of them crying there on the sidewalk was making me begin to feel. I wanted to leave, but was too ashamed to leave, was rapidly becoming too much a part of it to leave. I turned aside and looked at the clutter of household objects which the two men continued to pile on the walk. As the crowd pushed me, I looked down to see, looking out of an oval frame, a portrait of the old couple when young. Seeing the sad, stiff dignity of the faces there, feeling strange memories awaken that began an echoing in my head like that of a hysterical voice stuttering in a dark street, seeing them look back at me as though even then, in that 19th-century day, they had expected little, and this with a grim, unillusioned pride that suddenly seemed to me both a reproach and a warning. My eyes fell upon a pair of crudely carved and polished bones, knocking bones, used to accompany music at country dances, used in blackface minstrels. The flat ribs of a cow, a steer, or sheep, flat bones that gave off a sound when struck like heavy castanets. Had he been a minstrel? Or the wooden block of a set of drums? Pots and pots of green plants were lined in the dirty snow, certain to die of the cold. Ivy, canna, a tomato plant. And in a basket I saw a straightening comb, switches of false hair, a curling iron, a card with silvery letters against a background of dark red velvet reading, "God bless our home." And scattered across the top of a chiffonier were nuggets of High John the Conqueror, the Lucky Stone. And as I watched the white men put down a basket in which I saw a whiskey bottle filled with rock candy and camphor, a small Ethiopian flag, a faded tintype of Abraham Lincoln, and the smiling image of a Hollywood star torn from a magazine. And on a pillow, several badly cracked pieces of delicate china, a commemorative plate celebrating the St. Louis World's Fair. I stood in a kind of daze, looking at an old folded lace fan studded with jet and mother of pearl. The crowd surged as the white men came back, knocking over a drawer that spilled its contents in the snow at my feet. I stooped and started replacing the articles. A bent Masonic emblem, a set of tarnished cufflinks, 3 brass rings, a dime pierced with a nail hole so as to be worn about the ankle on a string for luck, an ornate greeting card with the message, "Grandma, I love you," in childish scrawl. Another card, with a picture of what looked like a white man in blackface seated in the door of a cabin, strumming a banjo beneath a bar of music and the lyric, "Going back to my old cabin home." A useless inhalant, a string of bright glass beads with a tarnished clasp, a rabbit foot, a celluloid baseball scoring card shaped like a catcher's mitt, registering a game won or lost years ago, an old breast pump with rubber bulb yellowed with age, a worn baby shoe, and a dusty lock of infant hair tied with a faded and crumpled blue ribbon. I felt nauseated. In my hand, I held 3 lapsed life insurance policies with perforated seals stamped void, a yellowing newspaper portrait of a huge black man with the caption, "Marcus Garvey, deported." I turned away, bending and searching the dirty snow for anything missed by my eyes, and my fingers closed upon something, resting in a frozen footstep, a fragile paper coming apart with age, written in black ink, grown yellow. I read, "Free papers. Be it known to all men that my Negro, Primus Provo, has been freed by me this 6th day of August, 1859. Signed, John Samuels, Macon." I folded it quickly, blotting out the single drop of melted snow which glistened on the yellowed page, and dropped it back into the drawer. My hands were trembling, my breath rasping, as if I had run a long distance or come upon a coiled snake in a busy street. It has been longer than that. Further removed in time, I told myself. And yet, I knew that it hadn't been. I replaced the drawer in the chest and pushed drunkenly to the curb. But it wouldn't come up. Only a bitter spurt of gall filled my mouth and splattered the old folks' possessions. I turned and stared again at the jumble, no longer looking at what was before my eyes, but inwardly, outwardly, around a corner into the dark, far away, and long ago. Not so much of my own memory as of remembered words, of linked verbal echoes, images heard even when not listening at home. And it was as though I myself was being dispossessed of some painful yet precious thing which I could not bear to lose. Something confounding, like a rotted tooth that one would rather suffer indefinitely than endure the short, violent eruption of pain that would mark its removal. And with this sense of dispossession came a pang of vague recognition. This junk, these shabby chairs, these heavy, old-fashioned pressing irons, zinc wash tubs with dented bottoms, all throbbed within me with more meaning than there should have been. And why did I, standing in the crowd, see like a vision my mother hanging wash on a cold, windy day, so cold that the warm clothes froze even before the vapor thinned and hung stiff on the line, and her hands white and raw in the skirt swirling wind, and her gray head bare to the darkened sky? Why were they causing me discomfort so far beyond their intrinsic meaning as objects? And why did I see them now, as behind a veil that threatened to lift, stirred by the cold wind in the narrow street?
And that's where we will conclude for this week. We are still in the middle of chapter 13, the eviction chapter is rather lengthy, so we'll pick up there and resume next Friday. Context of white supremacy. That veil reference going back to the college, methinks. If you have commentary you would like to share, the number 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in, if you have commentary you would like to share, we have about 30 minutes left in the broadcast. If we have any folks who have not participated at all and you have comments, questions, thoughts you would like to share, do not wait till the last minute. Go ahead and get your hand up right now. That way we will not miss you. All the other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, comments to share, line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello. Thank you for allowing me to share again. A couple comments on the previous chapter. I think it was chapter 12. The first thing was when Mary was talking to him, I definitely feel like Mary reminds me of my own grandmother, and just definitely like a Black grandmother, a typical or a somewhat more imagined Black grandmother, but how she was saying it's the ones from the South that's going to do it, basically bring about the change, the ones who know the fire. And I think that's, you know, kind of reminiscent of us still being kind of confused, like, you know, racism is only in the South, when that's definitely, you know, not the case. I definitely appreciated the long part where when he goes back to Men's house, but he comes to the point where it's kind of like, you know, he can no longer kind of show off based upon this theory or this myth or whatever, that he was supposed to come up north just to work and then go back to school and supposed to come up north to get like a good job or whatever. And so the people aren't looking at him the same way, don't have that same admiration for him. And so when he's going through the whole, like, everybody that's in the lobby area or the meeting area, when he's talking about the janitors and the messengers who spent most of their money on fancy clothes, like Wall Street brokers, definitely can understand that, and just kind of going back to us wanting to kind of be as close to whiteness as possible in our dress and speech and act, as if that's going to make it better for us. And especially if we are almost, you know, going broke, these people are janitors and messengers, and, you know, making sure that they know the proper way to eat and carrying the Wall Street Journal, even if they don't really read it. You know, if the Wall Street Journal is supposed to be something to help them make money, not really understanding that part of it. But I definitely appreciated that. And maybe even not, maybe them just wanting to show off, because kind of how the Invisible Man was wanting to, you know, show off for other Black people, and at the same time trying to be as palatable for whites. The other thing that Marriott said, basically, you know, was just when he had actually decided to move in with her, you know, and him not having any money, because his compensation money ran out. And that was another thing, you know, he could have really been, you know, injured, but they only gave him enough money for just, I'm assuming, maybe a few months, which is definitely reminiscent. It makes me think about, you know, the story from the compensatory call-in, you know, $4 for that, the Black male who got gunned down. She had said that, you know, everybody's going through hard times and, you know, we'll get past it. Definitely something that I've heard older people say, but not quite, you know, finishing the story of, well, who is causing these hard times? And, you know, this isn't something that, you know, we're just going to, these hard times are going to, you know, make us better. Kind of like, well, you know, what doesn't kill you make you stronger. That's kind of what that makes me think. And that's kind of the confusion. And I guess just a couple other things. There was in the chapter 13, there was a passage that several people had highlighted. It says, I'm not sure, but it was like a a passage that a lot of people had noted. It was the one that says, "What and how much had I lost by trying to do only what was expected of me instead of what I myself had wished to do? What a waste, what a senseless waste." And I just thought that was interesting. It says that, 1,422 people highlighted that or thought that that was memorable. The last thing, a couple other things, definitely thought that the old woman who was getting evicted, how she was saying some true things, you know, it's all of them are against us. And then how the invisible man, when he saw the old woman sobbing, it was kind of strange to him. And just kind of that kind of makes me feel like, you know, maybe this might be another point to where he's not, he's kind of becoming less confused, even though, you know, he's supposed to be an individual. It's still seeing another black person going through an oppression kind of gives you that sense. But he still described it as something being strange, which that's what we're taught. We're supposed to be strange for other black people to go through things. And we're supposed to separate ourselves from that. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Appreciate that. Red in Las Vegas. Other folks, if you have a hand up, comments, questions you would like to add, feel free.
May I be heard?
Greetings. Caller 3637.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for taking my calls. Caller with from the 712. I took a little bit of noting, but I would like to start off with just a general question about the book. If the Invisible Man graduated high school, I think, in the beginning, and we know that black people was only allowed to go to, what, eighth or ninth grade? So when he went to college, I'm just confused on that. When they went to college, when they only went to the eighth grade, did they just hop up to university-level learning, or do we know more about that?
I don't know if he went directly from eighth grade. I think when it starts with the battle, I mean, certainly now that is, you know, accurate. That time period, racist white supremacists, they did a phenomenal job making sure that black children did not have access to, you know, high quality education. Absolutely historically correct. I think in this text, I don't think he went to college like from the eighth grade. I'd have to look back at the first chapter to see if they specify like an exact age, but I remember the children from the, or at least the narrator from the Battle Royal, I think he would have been older than 13 when he matriculates to school, to college.
Okay. He always wondered about that. If we weren't allowed to go to school, I mean, only up until the eighth grade, then how do you just hop up and go to college? But all right, that's a little bit better understanding. And then you asked a question about, did he ever say anything like he wanted to do something like some killing to some white people, because he keeps coming at the black people, you know, ready to murder them or whatever. And I think I remember in the beginning when the stripper was dancing, I think he did say some good things about her, but I thought he said something about he had wanted to kill her or something, or she was better off if he killed her. I'm just thinking back off of memory. If anybody remember that, I could be mistaken. I could be getting it mixed up with something else. But and for my notes that I took while I was at work here, I took down that Lucius set the invisible man up, because Lucius kind of giggled when he was running away, and he was kind of laughing like he might have knew that this was about to blow up. And that made me think of, maybe, I don't know if he might have set him up for that. I don't know. But the scene when he was in the machine, when he was at the factory, the quote-unquote factory hospital, like the other caller said, that was so reminiscent of medical apartheid. It was just absolutely disgusting. They didn't know if they want to do a castration on him. I believe they did that full frontal lobal removal thing because he didn't remember anything. And I think that's what that does. I think, if I'm not mistaken, it does. You forget things. Also wanted to point out with the factory hospital, I feel like white people, well, I don't feel they do this. They'll, like, maybe there's some low-grade doctors, or maybe they just quite didn't finish medical school. And so I feel like they'll send those people to places like this. Maybe you couldn't get into a regular hospital, but they'll send you to a place like this. And then you get to indulge in free experimentation on people like they were doing to the invisible man. So they'll have all these industries for these flunky, these basically lower grade white people. And then they can go into something like this. I can work at the factory hospital. As a white person, I wasn't that smart, so I couldn't finish medical school, but I know my cousin has a factory hospital in his factory, and I could just go work there as a low-grade medical person and do all these hack jobs and experimentations on whoever gets an accident at my cousin's factory. I'm speaking as a racist white supremacist would. And again, good reading, excellent book. I always enjoyed the part when he was talking about the yams, and it's really about to get, I mean, the whole book is really good, but this, after the scene with when the older people get evicted is really, yeah, it's good. So thank you so much for letting me speak, and I'll go ahead and mute my line now.
Yes, ma'am. Appreciate that caller in the 712. I think Mr. Demery Ford mentioned after the first audio segment that he also came to the conclusion that Mr. Lucius Brockway, that he deliberately caused the explosion in the power plant to set up the narrator. It seems he's already talked about different codes that he has to keep his job. He's really paranoid that people are trying to come down and take his job. So, yes, Mr. Demery Ford, myself and others, I think, have concluded that Mr. Brockway, he did this deliberately to set up the narrator. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, if you have commentary you'd like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Yes, ma'am, I'm here.
Mr. Demery Ford.
Oh, yes. Okay. Let's see. Yeah, he's going back to the men's house. And like the female caller said earlier, that, you know, he had been there feeling, you know, sort of special, I guess, being in college and the peer pressure. You know, but when he goes back and now he feels, you know, he feels strange because he goes back and he's looking at these guys and it sums it up as a collection of college boys, washed up preachers, and well-dressed nobodies. So it seems he can quickly go to, you know, all the negative aspects of, you know, black people's existence. But he can't really put all this together, how the system of white supremacy is the oppression from white control environment is causing this thing. And knowing that the men are going to probably poke fun at him and all this, and his dream was over, then he knew he had to leave. And it was kind of like he's leaving on his own and what goes back to Mary's house. And then it was interesting that how he was relating black cultural life to foods like yams, chitlins, and that's supposed to represent a kind of black inferiority. Inferiority. Which has nothing to do with anything, because black people were eating that type of stuff out of necessity, you know, through the years. And then I guess it just became, you know, some type of bad eating habits that they call soul food. And he's starting to understand that something's going on. He's recognizing the system and he's getting angry. And he says something, he compares his feeling of anger to an ice cap over the old way of thinking. But that ice cap is melting. And when the provost, the old couple, was being evicted from their residence. The lady, I can't remember her name, she mentioned telling the movers take their hands off her Bible. She was adamant about that, and the eviction makes this whole white terrorism real to the narrator, because he can see people actually being harmed and dispossessed. But then a crowd gathers around, and he sees everybody expressing anger, but nobody's bold enough to do anything to organize or try to prevent this type of thing. And the man's papers, freedom papers, laying in the street, and the wife begging to get back into the apartment so she can pray some more. So you can see the influence that religion has had on Black people in a negative way. I'll mute my line. Thanks, God.
Much obliged. Any listeners, if you have additional comments that you would like to share, do not wait till the last minute. We have about 10 minutes left in the broadcast. A few of the notes that I took from chapter 12. And again, we didn't even finish chapter 13, so we'll come back to that next week. He starts chapter, or where we picked up rather, from chapter 12, where he's going to the men's house. He's going to get his stuff and head to Mary's, where he says he was filled with a sense of alienation and hostility. I think that is par for the system of white supremacy, to have us disconnected from ourselves, angry, frustrated. We take that out on ourselves and each other, not whites. The next portion where he goes into extraordinary detail, the meticulous detail that he invests in describing some of the characters or the scenes, it's just, it is amazing, just the artistry. And it's, I mean, it's purposeful detail, where he describes the men's house and these victims of white supremacy and the things that they're doing to compensate for being in such a weak position as a result of white supremacy. Some of this, I mean, there's truth to it, right? I'm reminded of, we talked about this before, I see truth to this even now, 2018, where non-white people, we do all kinds of things to compensate for the system of white supremacy so that we do not appear as weak as we are in the system. That's, you know, ongoing. However, when it's not directly connected to the system of white supremacy, at times it can sound just like, you know, there's something just messed up about Black people. These folks are just morons and idiots. Not, they are responding to the system of white supremacy. I was just comparing that to, there are a lot of passages of anti-Blackness in the first portion of the text when the narrator is still confused. This may be another. The next, where he says, when he talks about going to throw the pitcher of, I guess, where a spittoon basically is what it sounds like, where he goes to grab the spittoon and throw it on the reverend. He thinks it's Dr. Bledsoe. Again, anger, not going to take it out directly on a white person, another Black person. It's not even the correct Black person. That anti-Blackness, again, and specifically, we can be angry with other Black people. We can fight, stomp, be violent with other Black people. Not the same sort of response with whites, who have done way more for us to be angry. Let's see. Another paragraph where, again, I go back to what I said. I think this is hugely important. We should pay attention to this the rest of the way. Ellison, ferociously angry. And I think his rage about white supremacy comes through in his writing. Another paragraph where I would submit, he says, I wanted peace and quiet, tranquility, but was too much a boil inside, somewhere beneath the load of the emotion, freezing ice, which my life had conditioned my brain to produce. A spot of Black anger glowed and threw off a hot red light of such intensity that had Lord Kelvin known of its existence, he would have had to revise his measurements. A remote explosion had occurred somewhere, perhaps back at Emerson's, or that night in Bledsoe's office and it had caused the ice cap to melt and shift the slightest bit, but that bit, that fraction, was irrevocable. Again, wow, the artistry of that writing, and I think that is Ellison speaking directly to his own frustrations as a victim of white supremacy, and it seems that he's keeping these temperature metaphors, hot and cold, and he talks about hot anger later on at the eviction. Perhaps we should pay attention to that as well, hot, cold temperature references from now to the remainder of the book. Let's see, one of the first things I think I wrote from or a note that I took from chapter 13, the very beginning, when he says, "At first I turned away from the window and tried to read, but my mind kept wandering back to my old problems and unable to endure it any longer, I rushed from the house, extremely agitated, but determined to get away from my hot thoughts into the chill air." The influence of the religion of white supremacy, I think, is been on display throughout the text thus far, even with Mary, biblical name, the Mary that he's staying with. And then the next chapter when we go to the eviction, or before we get to the eviction, where he's passing the windows and he sees Mary and Jesus surrounded by dream books. Also thought when he's on his walk before he gets to the eviction, he says, I passed onto a window decorated with switches of wiry false hair, ointments guaranteed to produce the miracle of whitening black skin. You too can be truly beautiful, a sign proclaimed when greater happiness with whiter complexion be outstanding in your social set. I hurried on, suppressing a savage urge to push my fist through the pain. P-A-N-E, although P-A-I-N, but I thought that was important as well. This is what the system of white supremacy produces. 2018 or 1952, when this book was published, anti-blackness. You are supposed to despise black people, anything associated with black or black people. And that's what you get. That's what you, in my view, that's what you've heard from the narrator and pretty much all of the black characters, Bledsoe, everyone, a contempt for black people. You see it right here with the whitening. White is right. Black get back. You see that throughout the text, and that rage is so quickly that that rage can be turned against other black people. Let's see. When he gets his yams from a black male in an army overcoat, again, this is supposed to be, even though the book was published in 52, this portion of the novel is taking place in the 1920s, just shortly after the end of World War II, black veterans being abused and mistreated, this old black male being out, and he might even be Civil War veteran, because he is older, significantly older, so he might even be older than a World War I veteran. Let's see. The shame, I think that's a big part of racism, white supremacy, when he has his dream montage about Dr. Bledsoe sneaking to eat chitlins. Hilarious, extremely well written. But again, funny and truth there, the system of white supremacy, I think Mr. Fuller talks about frequently, when you reveal truth about the system of white supremacy, the response or the reaction of victims is embarrassment. It's embarrassing the position that we are in. So not surprising that would be the response he's predicting from just truth being revealed. And the system encourages non-white people to be ashamed about everything, be ashamed about the way you look. That's why you got to have all these whitening creams, and be ashamed about your hair, and be ashamed about the food that we have forced on you, since we don't allow you to come to our Whole Foods and what have you. Let's see. The scene, I think Mr. Demery Ford talked about it, again, in my view, it just goes back to that point that I'm bringing about Ellison, him being in a state of rage about the system of white supremacy, murderously angry, and not necessarily having an outlet for that when he's at this eviction and seeing all these black people out being spectators watching this and saying, but ain't that much nerve in the whole bunch? And the next person says, there's plenty of nerve. The slender man said, all they need is someone to set it off. All they need is a leader. You mean you don't have enough nerve? These type of conversations, I think, are rife throughout the system of white supremacy. I think the next time there's a police shooting, you'll hear this sort of thing. Why haven't we done something? Black people are too much of cowards. We don't fight back. All of that, I think, goes back to that same point I'm bringing up with Ellison about us being angry about the system of white supremacy, not knowing what to do, not knowing where or how to fight back, to strike back, feeling that our anger has been castrated in some way, and then it being released on other black people. You see a lot of that name calling right here in the crowd. He gets angry. In fact, that was another. He says a flash of heat when he doesn't understand what's happening and they start cracking on him, making jokes. He gets upset with them. He says a flash of heat went over me and I turned. Look, friends, I said, hearing a hot edge coming into my voice. And then they go, you know, back and forth with their squabble. But that anger doesn't get directed at the correct person. It's going to come out on other victims of white supremacy. I think, the great portion, the victim of the eviction, when she says, they're against us all, every stinking lowdown, one of them, she's right. A hoarse voice said, she's right. They all is. Great passage in Truth. Primus Provo, the slave the free papers for this enslaved black person. Number one, it reminded me of Dr. Kevorkian's point about enslaved people being given Latin names, totally stripping, erasing your name and then giving you some Latin name. And I also thought it was significant. You see all of these relics being tossed out as trash, rubbish. The free papers, the newspaper with Marcus Garvey's news of his deportation, the discarded card from a child, granddaughter, all of these things that, you know, would seem to suggest a previous time of hope or a chance for improvement for black people to try to better themselves. The Civil War is over. We're free. Things are going to be better. Marcus Garvey, he's helped, same time period, right after the beginning of the 20th century. Things are going to be better. He's going to help us move on and accomplish things as black people. And then to see those hopes dashed, all of this stuff thrown out in the trash. I think that's huge. Ellison talking about black people always having this notion of hope and looking towards, you know, a better day, a brighter day, or things being better. And then those hopes being dashed and black people once again being left hopeless, frustrated, angry. Any final thoughts? Folks want to make sure they get in before we wrap, that you can get in 60 seconds. Are folks good for the week? We'll assume folks are all satisfied. Again, we'll pick up on chapter 13. We're kind of in the midpoint of the eviction in chapter 13. So next Friday, normal program time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here on Saturday, tomorrow evening, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific for the compensatory call-in. Dial in. We will exchange views, what's going down the last 7 days, and if folks have any counter-racist suggestions to solve the problem. Much obliged to everyone who tuned in. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Hope folks are enjoying the book. Huge fan of Ralph Ellison. We're about halfway to the finish line. Again, if you listen to the archives, if you have questions, if you want to respond to any of the questions that were asked, or if you have your own thoughts, you can drop an email. We will still have weeks to go before we get to the end of the book, so we can read your comments or thoughts on the air. That said, if folks would recall, I know it's summertime, or almost officially summertime, getting warm, people are graduating and got their vacation plans and all that good stuff. Phenomenal. Have fun. Send me a postcard. However, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, even if you are frolicking on vacation. Racists, they do not stop because it's summertime and the weather's nice. If you're going to be out and about, you still want to make great decisions to keep yourself safe. Dr. Welsing, many of the folks that we esteem, they would strongly encourage, yes, let's practice sobriety. Keep our brain computers safe and functioning optimally so that we can solve this problem, fulfill our cosmic assignment, as Dr. Welsing says, to produce justice. Certainly, if we're going to be out and about, you want to be sober and buckled up. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you're so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.